You wish to know all, even if it be bad, even if it be sorrow.
I'm braced for the worst.
I see a violent death.
Always starts that way.
I see you and I on the scene.
Something lurking in the background?
Yes. I see another violent death.
The trail's warming up.
I see danger approaching. It comes closer. I see you attacked by two large...
What?
Things.
I dispose of them? I do dispose of them.
No, I do.
This is Bristol. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. And the date is Friday the 23rd of February 2024 today. Again, a little bit echoey this week. I'm sorry, folks. I mean, it sounds as if we're very amateurish talking to you from the bathroom. But I'm afraid our sound insulation has been taken down. Apparently, it doesn't look quite as nice as it should for the other people using the radio studio here. Hopefully by next week we'll have something. So that's why we're sounding a little bit bathroom-like, I'm afraid. So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol and on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Any problems with the app, by the way, just uninstall it and reinstall it. And anyway, it will take up much less room on your phone if you do that. Uninstall the thing and then reinstall it. Because what happens is, as it gets updated, you find it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it's a giant, great, bloated thing that's taking up half your phone. And the best thing to do is just delete the whole thing and reinstall the beautiful new version. And it's a fantastic new version Nick has put up over the last week or so of our app on the various app stores. Aurora and I think, isn't it called Google Play, the horrid one that no one should use, but sometimes you have to, and also on the Apple Store. So a terrific little app which will now enable you to much more easily navigate the longer versions of the interview that get popped up online every Friday evening around about midnight. You'll find them all up there, and that is, so if there's anything you're particularly interested in the show and you wanted to hear the whole interview, that I've just got a few clips, I've got four this week actually, that's where you can find it on the app. So thanks Nick. So we are available from all good app stores. As I say, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner gaslighting us with its military grade propaganda, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. Seems to be getting worse all the time. McCarthyite witch hunts going on after anyone with influence who seems to speak up for humanity these days and against the wage slavery lies. So for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to every crisis, whether it's Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, cost of living, climate, the accelerationists, the Armageddonists, policies designed to make every crisis worse. Have you noticed? And we'll be hearing a bit more about that right at the end of the show this week. Nick Land's behaviourist dark enlightenment drones this week from Nick himself, my old school friend from the 1970s, speaking about why actually there's no point in trying to steer history in the right direction, because actually the future is coming backwards towards us and there's nothing we can do about it. Now that's his Nietzschean philosophy, but I have a few doubts myself. So that will be interesting right at the very end of the show, a little bit from Nick Land himself. Thank you very much to Dave Bazanko, our sound engineer, for pointing that one out to me. So anyway, part one this week, we have a look at Bristol's new gay Labour MP, who's married, allegedly, according to Mint Press News, to an Israeli agent who's been recruiting for their version of GCHQ. So his gay partner, actually no, husband, as they're two husbands, is being listed as a recruiter for the Israeli Signals Intelligence Service. What is he doing as our new Bristol Kingswood MP? Also, Teflon Lindsay Hoyle sabotages the Scottish National Party's collective punishment in inverted commas, Gaza ceasefire bill on Wednesday evening, but that's still been sort of bubbling away in the news. And it turns out that Labour leader Keir Starmer boasts actually about chit-chatting with Isaac Herzog, the Israeli president, before he decided on the wording of his wrecking amendment, which did wreck it all on, no wonder the SNP and everyone else is so annoyed about it. Part two, Trump's legal cases, and also interesting to hear what he's saying about his own foreign policy if he becomes president in November. We'll be hearing from the Pakistan Society in Bristol here about Pakistan, what's been going on in the elections there. And specifically, Farouk Sadiq talks about some of the more horrific tales which the Pakistani press are distributing, but which are not being heard in this part of the world or via Al Jazeera from Gaza. That's Farouk Sadiq. We hear a bit from Vanessa Bealey, a special interview with her about Gaza, and particularly why next door neighbours, the Egyptians, who was her father was British ambassador to Egypt for a while, why aren't they doing more to help? She explains just why, and it's pretty shocking stuff. And also we hear, as well as from Nick Land, to counter that to a certain extent, we are hearing from David Livingston on the Western intelligence origins of Hamas. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not quite cancelled here yet. And I'm joined in the studio by the Bristol Tree Forum's John Tarleton and also Vasily Papastavrou. Did I do that right? Vasily, I've met you before, haven't I? I met you once quite recently, actually, looking at planning in the city. So what does the Tree Forum, what is it all about?
Well, everyone loves trees, except in a city there's there's basically a competition for space, and developers don't really love trees because they get in the way of big developments. So what we're seeing in Bristol is when each big development appears, all the trees on the site get it. And we're seeing a sort of hollowing out of Bristol, where all the big trees in the middle of Bristol are being chopped down, and we have vague promises of replacements being planted. But actually, all that really happens is the money gets put in the bank in a Bristol City Council bank account, and very few trees are actually planted. And if they're planted, they're trees that will never become large. So enjoy the big trees of Bristol while you still can, because in the centre of Bristol, they're not going to be around for much longer.
John, can you talk about the Tree Forum itself, how you got started with that and what's the point?
Yes, well, the Tree Forum started, I think, around about 2007, something like that. I've been part of the Tree Forum for about 16 years. So I think I joined a couple of years after it had actually started. Vasily was actually one of the founder members, so he's probably better to talk about why it started. But my understanding was that at the time, those trees that were planted for Plant a Tree in 73 became under threat because Bristol City Council did a survey of those trees. And as a result of tree surveys, very often what happens is people identify the problems with the trees and decide they need to be chopped down. So I think the Bristol Tree Forum started as a response to that, and we've been trying to save trees ever since.
What about the ash? A lot of ash are having to come down, aren't they?
Yes. So the ash is a very real problem. It's ash dieback, and it structurally weakens the trees, and it's an imported disease. We're very, very poor on our biosecurity in this country. So if you take a country like Iceland, they're incredibly careful about what they allow in and out of the country. But in our case, we've got not just ash dieback, but a whole range of other tree diseases coming in. And the real worry with ash dieback is it makes the tree dramatically unsafe, so that basically you might be standing under it and a whole branch just drops on your head or the tree falls over. So unfortunately, we're going to see a very big change in the countryside with many ash trees going, But actually, in the centre of Bristol, they're not the tree that's predominantly there that was planted by the Victorians and later by
So this is mainly
tree
a
in
problem,
73.
Mainly a problem for country woodlands and things like that. I mean, I remember one of the walks I regularly go on, not far from, where is it? In between Stroud and Dursley area somewhere. There's a lot, loads and loads of ash have been cut back. A couple of years ago, and you can see actually the new shoots coming up, and you look and you think, well, maybe that's going to know. Apparently they don't. They'll do another 4 or 5 years and then they'll start dying back too. So this is a serious problem. I had a chat to Robin Maynard about this, who's, I think he was ex-Friends of the Earth. He was doing Population Watch, which is a pretty awful thing to have been doing, but he was doing it anyway. And he said, well, the Woodland Trust introduced ash dieback, because they brought in seedlings from Holland that they had been told were grown in Holland, but they weren't actually. They were from somewhere in Asia. And because they thought that it was okay to bring them from Holland, and they weren't actually really from Holland, they brought this disease in with them. But, of course, the Woodland Trust are the last people in the world that would like to really admit to having brought ash dieback to Britain. So this is really Robin's story, but, I mean, he's in a position to know about these kinds of things, and so I think that's feasible.
One thing I was going to say was the ash dieback is a really going to hit a lot of trees in this country, but they think around about 5% of them are possibly resistant to the disease. So it is important that if actually you do have an ash tree that isn't looking as though it's got ash dieback, that you should be retaining it, because it seems that those that are resistant will pass on their resistance to their offspring. So,
oh, brilliant. Well,
any saplings that come out as a result of a resistant tree are also likely to be
what
resistant.
What about, I mean, Dutch elm is a funny one as well, isn't it? Because that was when I was a kid, I can remember, I've told this story a few times, I suppose we'd be about 7, 8 years old or something, we were stood there completely silent. The kids were normally raucous, making loads of racket, we always did. But as these two elms were being sawn down on our piece of land, we used to play around as kids, all the children were silent. We watched these two trees come down, and actually just about every single elm was felled by that. But then we found there was a few in Brighton, and actually the Queen had her own elm tree which had survived very, very happily. I'm not sure if it was in Windsor or Sandringham, one of these places, but purely because every time there was a sign of decay on the tree, that the tree surgeons had come in, clipped it off, taken it out, burnt it and got rid of it, and so that elm tree survive fine. So there are ways of dealing with this. It's just that, you know, it's lots and lots and lots of manpower involved in trying to do that to a whole load of ash. But anyway, so the big development going on at the moment in Bristol has got to be the St Mary-le-Port possible development. It looks actually as if it's becoming potentially financially unviable and less likely. But can you say something about that? Because that's really, I won't use the word iconic. I hate people that do, but it is right in the middle of Bristol. It's the centre of Bristol. We had Joe Banks on here a couple of weeks ago talking about this development. It really is in the middle of the Central Park, where all people in the city centre sort of chip off there in their lunch breaks and sit and have a bit of relaxation in the summer, sit cross-legged on the grass and all that sort of thing. There's some beautiful mature trees around there that have grown up ever since it was bombed in World War II.
Yeah, well, there's a number of, in particular, a number of plane trees that surround the development site. Some of them are being retained, but we're going to be losing something like 10 mature plane trees, and these are big, big trees. It's also going to be losing a few smaller trees as well, which are probably of less consequence. But the our argument had been all along is actually by just shifting the footprint of the building, they could actually retain all of those trees and wouldn't have to fell a single one. Of course, part of the planning process means that if you do fell a tree, you're supposed to replace that tree, and there's a calculation for how many trees should replace a single mature tree, because obviously when you plant a tree, it's a lot smaller. I think it's around about 50-odd trees are going to supposedly be planted in replacement. But as we found elsewhere, there's actually nowhere to plant them. So what happens instead is the developer pays a fee to the council, and the council put it into their bank account, and it sits there, supposedly being used for replacement trees, but in reality, actually, it isn't. And there's round about, well, it's edging towards about £1 million in the tree replacement budget that is unspent, simply because there's nowhere to plant the trees. And this is a particular problem in the city centre, where it's just absolutely chock-a-block. There's no space. Therefore, every tree that you should have, you should value very highly and not fell it in the first place.
Vasily, what do you make of this development? Would it, you know, we just heard from John, it may have been possible just to have a different footprint of the buildings and not to be knocking these trees down.
Yeah, well, other local authorities do it. So in Islington, there's a case study of a very big building that's built quite close to some existing trees. And there, the local planning authority said right at the very beginning to the developer, we will only give you permission if you retain these trees. And they went to incredible lengths to build this huge building around the existing trees. And the result is spectacular. And in fact, we do have one or two examples in Bristol. One is actually not quite Bristol, but it's nearly Bristol. And it's the visitor centre for the suspension bridge. So it's on the far side of the bridge. And there's actually a cutout of the roof line of the building to accommodate branches of a tree that's right next to it. So here, the architects, or rather over there for the visitor centre, they'd actually decided to incorporate the tree into the design and retain the tree. But of course, it's much easier if you just flatten the entire site, remove everything, and you can get your big diggers in. You don't have to worry about anything. So essentially, it's all about profit. And if we've got a very hostile environment for trees in Bristol, and it's not at all like Islington, and as a result, developers know that they don't need to retain any trees on a development site.
So what we're really talking about is just shove a wad of cash to the council to stick in their special mega bank account, which, I mean, this sounds a little bit to me like this whole idea of carbon offset, where if you've done something, say, for example, British Rail have to pay this. They're using some diesel or whatever. They're using something to propel their trains around, which is supposedly uses too much carbon. They can offset that by paying private equity firms to go and buy farmland and just plant trees. Now, this has actually annoyed the farmers quite a lot, because they're finding that it's almost impossible to... it's been very pronounced in Wales, where local farmers just cannot buy land because land prices have gone through the roof because of this. So what do you make of this whole side of the carbon agenda, isn't it? I mean, some are very, very pro it. Some think it's really important to, and others think it's just some kind of scam.
So carbon offsetting, someone described it as committing a crime and paying someone else to go to jail for you. And it really doesn't solve the immediate problem, which is that a tree has gone in the middle of Bristol. And yes, we can plant a replacement on the outskirts of Bristol or somewhere else, but that's not going to bring any benefit to the middle of Bristol. Mm. And in the case of urban trees, we're not so much talking about carbon. We're talking about the fact that they're cooling the city in hot weather. They're providing amenity value for the people who live in the city. And of course, if you're planting replacements somewhere else, or in the case of Bristol, not planting them at all, obviously you gain no local benefit whatsoever.
Do you guys actually have any genuine involvement in planning applications? Do the council actually obliged to listen to you in any way at all?
Well, they're not obliged to listen to us, but they we do contribute whenever there are any trees being lost. We will chip in and suggest to them alternative ways of doing things. And I think one of the things that we've come across again and again is whenever they talk about replacing trees, the reality is actually they just pay money to the council. And as Vasily says, it's the importance of trees in a city aren't just about the carbon sequestration, although you can have something like a large oak be sequestering many tons of carbon. The main thing is the ecological services they provide, the cooling they get in heat waves. And the suggestion is that a single tree will perhaps cool the air immediately around it by as much as 10 degrees. So when you've got a really high temperature during a heat wave, having trees is really important. And there's a recent study found that in the eastern side of the United States, they wondered why it was that the temperatures hadn't risen quite as much as what had been expected. And lo and behold, they found out the reason for this is because lots of trees were planted over the last 50 years. So these trees are absolutely crucial. They reduce flooding, which is obviously an issue in cities. They reduce pollution by absorbing pollutants from the air. They reduce noise. So all of these things are just hugely beneficial, but hugely any beneficial in the city centre more than anywhere else. And that's where we're losing the trees. And even though they may be replacing them, ultimately those replacements are going to be on the outskirts of Bristol, not where you need them.
Well, I can remember chatting with and being shown, this is with journalists at the Bristol Post, at the very top floor there where the executive suite was, there's a whole load of seagulls were moving in, and they found it very embarrassing when they're taking their guests out for a look across the city from the executive suite that they would be bombarded by seagulls, and if they weren't, they would be slipping over on seagull droppings everywhere. And I think they eventually got a some sort of model of a hawk to sort of prop up to make it look as if the seagulls. But anyway, the fact is birds, really. Seagulls seem to get quite an easy ride in the city, but other birds that would be nesting in trees like the ones we're losing, we could be anyway in Castle Park, you know. So what about that bird life?
Well, yes, I mean, something like an oak tree is thought to support as many as 2,300 different species. So that includes birds, it includes invertebrates, fungi, mosses, bacteria, all sorts of things. A whole ecosystem can be supported by a tree. And of course, birds need to nest, and nests are very often in trees. They will feed birds as well as other species that depend on the trees. But very often they actually create a corridor between green spaces within Bristol. You know, obviously we don't have green spaces all over Bristol, but those green spaces need to be connected, because otherwise, in isolation, they will just not be supporting anything. And trees are absolutely crucial in that, you know, not just birds, but invertebrates and mammals as well. So I think the ecological importance of trees to nature generally, and you've got to remember, the UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world. We need to increase our nature, and, you know, these things are all connected.
And the other thing not to forget is that people just like trees. And in National Tree Week last year, Bristol City Council decided to remove an iconic willow tree just by Temple Meads that was seen probably by thousands of people each day. And everyone went nuts about this because it was a lovely tree. They were removing it, having given themselves planning permission in a planning application that didn't mention the tree. So we weren't even aware it was happening. And it was decided as what's called a delegated decision. So it didn't even go to a planning committee. And so they thought, well, it wouldn't really matter. It's just a tree. We'll just chop it down. But they just didn't realise how much people loved the tree. And Bristol journalist Martin Booth happened to be cycling past while it was happening and videoed it being chopped down. And that was the start of a huge controversy, because suddenly the council realised that lots of people actually cared about this tree, which they felt had no value, so they could chop it down without a moment's thought. So people do actually like trees, and they have an aesthetic value.
Well, there is something quite symbolic about trees, isn't there? Just a sort of big symbol. I remember when that one on Hadrian's Wall was chopped down by somebody, people getting very upset about that for no apparent reason other than we really do love trees. And there's also this sort of image in my mind of the happy, mature oak tree that's been neglected for decades, and it's getting more and more ivy up it until it reaches the point where a heavy fall of snow brings it down, you know, because the neglect, these trees do need to be managed, don't they? We must have thousands of them lining our streets around the city. And in a way, you know, you can see why the developers say, well, who cares about a few plane trees in Castle Park? Loads and loads of the suburbs of Bristol have got trees down every side of the road.
Mm. Well, I mean, one thing to remember about trees as well is the fact that the older they get, the more important they become for nature. A tree that you look at and might think it's a bit dilapidated, it's got some holes in it and broken branches and things like that, those are the ones that actually provide the greatest number of ecological niches for various species. So I think it's important to, as well as maintaining trees within cities, because obviously they have to be safe, that's the important thing, but as much as possible, allow them to do what trees do, which is they do naturally.
Has the tree forum ever been listened to by Bristol City Council? I mean, it's a bit of an awkward question, maybe. I mean, obviously, you're putting in various submissions to these planning applications and things, but have you ever been... Have they ever said, oh, actually, crikey, maybe we better save this tree?
Yes, I think we have had some successes. So, for example, in the early days of the tree forum... there was a plan to chop down lots of ancient and veteran trees on Redland Green. And through really quite a large-scale campaign, we were able to turn that around. But it actually took people outside Bristol, to well-known people who are outside Bristol, to come and look at the trees and then say to Bristol, look, you really need to think again about this. And we had to... raised the money to commission reports to show that the trees were in fact not dangerous. We questioned the reports that the council themselves had produced, which were deeply flawed, which overestimated the risk by about 1,000 times, the risk of death from the tree. And it was basically, it was a long campaign that we did eventually win.
Another recent example is the Ashley Down Oak, which was a holm oak up on Ashley Down, an enormous tree, possibly hundreds of years old, we don't know exactly, but after a very long campaign, including people actually sitting in the tree, living in the tree, living in a tree house, eventually the council relented, and it was due to be felled because of supposed subsidence, but... has now, that felling has been reversed, and the tree is doing very well.
Did you? Were you involved in the occupation of the tree, as it were, or is that not the sort of thing that your tree forum does?
We can get involved in that. We certainly did help out. I never actually slept in the tree overnight myself, but I did go along there and provide food for people that were in the tree, and for the M32 maples, that was another campaign where we also. Occupied the trees. Unfortunately, those trees are now gone. But again, we were very supportive of the campaign. And a lot of the time, Bristol Tree Forum will provide technical help, advice and legal advice and so on. But we do get involved as well. We do get our hands dirty sometimes.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, this is like civic engagement as well as
absolutely,
everything else,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
People seeing that by getting involved and doing things, changes can be made.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, networks are built up and people, you know, learn how to do this stuff. Because obviously a lot of our, you know, the way people have to go to work and the consumer society we live in, it's very difficult to organise people. You know, you need something to bring people together, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, and another example is the Baltic Wharf, which has now just become fairly live because after a pause of possibly a couple of years, the planning office are now going ahead and trying to put a planning application through for Baltic Wharf, where we're going to be losing around about 100 trees in one of the most tree-depleted areas of Bristol, which is around the docks. And again, a situation where they said they were going to replace those trees with 162 tree replacements, but there's only actually two places where they can plant trees. So there's going to be 160 trees that are not going to be replacing those trees that are lost. And that planning meeting is going to be happening, I think, on the 5th or the 6th of March, and we're going to be there and trying to stop it from happening.
Yeah, I can also remember, I think it's in Stow-on-the-Wold, going to the parish church there, and half of the main door, you know, at the entranceway was a tree. It was a yew tree. A bit sort of quite Tolkien-esque, in fact. But the trees can actually be incorporated into buildings. Why on earth not? I suppose you might say, well, there'll be sort of little animals and bugs living in there. You don't want that in your living room. But this is supposed to be actually quite a trendy way of doing things. Why is it, do you think, that they're just considered to be in the way? It's in this latest case, for example, the one you're talking about at this forthcoming planning meeting. I mean, surely developers can see that there's an advantage to having, you know, maybe if it's even making the bringing up the price of the buildings to have a few trees around. People, when they see that, they will want, be more likely to buy it, surely.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think it'd be good if developers could actually take that approach. And that's one of the things we've been advocating for some time.
Yeah.
But, of course, most developers, what they want to do is they want to have a completely clear site.
What, you like sort of Gaza or something?
Yes. So, I mean, even better, they like to have green spaces, because then they don't have a building that they then need to demolish and move away. So somewhere like Baltic Wharf, which is basically an area just covered in trees, is ideal for them. But, unfortunately, that involves them chopping all the trees down.
Yeah, I suppose the developers kind of constantly scoping around the city, aren't they? So, oh, there's somewhere. Maybe if there was a little fire in there, then that would be such a shame. They'd have to condemn the building, and then we could move in and build loads of luxury flats. Isn't this what goes on in their minds?
Well, I think also it's not just in their minds. It's they're getting guidance from the planning officers.
Oh, yeah.
And there are a lot of informal discussions before even a plan is drawn up.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to a planning committee, the planning officers are all co-opted. They're all there supporting the plan, saying it's a wonderful thing. They're telling the development control committee members essentially to vote for it. And the opportunity to build something decent is lost. It was lost long ago. Whereas if the planning officers actually said at the very beginning, look, it's important for us to keep the trees, then of course they would do it.
But hang on, because actually here in Bristol we've got a particularly bad planning department. Now I would absolutely not single out any planning officer specifically, because I think a lot of them are, I mean, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, because they do their best sometimes to uphold the planning regulations, and then they find that there are political and developer their toes get trodden on by these people. And then when they go along with what the developer wants, of course, the public will really dislike. And it's an almost impossible task when it's politicised, as it has been so much here in Bristol. And it's been fascinating to watch with the St Mary Le Port development, which may still, we know as of last week, may not go ahead because of the finances don't necessarily stack up anymore. And it's certainly not going to be started until the summer at the earliest. We know that what's happened is through that process, many of the people in the planning department of various sorts who stood up and said, well, hang on, this is not appropriate, have been literally elbowed out.
And in some cases, the information they've produced was concealed. So looking at that development, looking at the tree information and looking at the various tree reports, the Bristol City Council tree planning officer, who is very good, wrote a scathing report about the development, and it was actually withheld until the evening before the planning committee meeting. It was then quietly released, and the publication date was backdated to give the impression it had been there all along. So the planning committee weren't even aware of what their own tree officer had to say about the development. And then following the decision, it took us 6 months of Freedom of Information requests to get the full tree reports. And this is information that should have been out in the open.
Well, it sounds like you need a little army of eco-warriors to help you find that, not only doing Freedom of Information requests, but lobbying those individuals who have been making such a mess. Now, look, the reason I came back in contact with you guys again is because of this allotment campaign. So I'd like you, one and then the other, to just talk about what you make of that, because there's some extraordinary rules to do with trees there, aren't there?
Well, the thing that I found incredible about it was the way a hornet's nest was stirred up in a way that and the reaction to it was a meeting of 200 people within a few days of the first announcement, a massive WhatsApp group, people who are good technically at going through the accounts, brilliant artists, people who are good at dressing up and demonstrating, amazing placards, and basically, you don't mess with allotmenteers. You know, they ran a fantastic campaign. And I think the issue was, once again, somebody in their bedroom drafted a policy on their own and thought it all sounded fine and did it without consulting with people. And well, we see this the whole
did
time.
That. They probably did that knowing that we've got a mayoral system and whatever the mayor says goes. So if the mayor says, yeah, I like that, or no, I don't, but in this case, yeah, I do, then it happens.
Yeah, I think that is part of it. But I think where they got it wrong was people who have allotments feel a very strong connection to that bit of space. And they reacted incredibly strongly to it. And we'd love to see campaigns with that sort of strength on all the other issues that are facing Bristol at the moment.
Yeah, I think one of the issues to remember is the fact that the tree cover in the more socially deprived areas of Bristol is much less than it is in other parts of Bristol. So there's enormous inequality in the tree cover in Bristol.
Yeah, if you go up to Clifton and all around that area, up on the Downs, for example, trees everywhere.
Yeah, they've got about 25% tree canopy cover there.
Massive.
Whereas somewhere like St Paul's has got about 7%. And I think in somewhere like Clifton, people have the resources and the time to spend on campaigns, which may not happen in those parts of Bristol where people are just basically struggling to survive and they don't have the time or the resources or the money to spend campaigning on these things. That's why it seems to be that in those most deprived areas of Bristol, we seem to be getting trees being lost all over the place, whereas those less deprived areas of Bristol, places like Clifton and Stoke Bishop and so on, you do lose trees, but generally speaking, the problem isn't as acute as it is in the more deprived areas.
Now, am I right in thinking, I think it was Mal Sainsbury we had on here a few weeks ago, she was talking about the council actually wanting people to chop trees down and charging people for them, this sort of thing. No?
Not come across that, no.
Having some sort of objection to trees is part of their the council's proposals. I don't know, maybe you hadn't seen that, I don't know.
I mean, in some cases, trees can be inconvenient to the council, but I think, generally speaking, the certainly the tree officers and the people that we deal with at the council are very much in favour of trees, but it seems to be the emphasis is more on planting trees, which tends to be in the outskirts, and not so much on retaining trees in the city centre, where we need them most.
How long do these sorts of mature plane trees on Castle Park, around that St Mary Le Port scheme, how long does it take them to get to maturity?
Well, you can get a pretty good idea by looking at the results of plant a tree in 73. And once you've got your eye in, you can wander around Bristol and identify all the trees, because they're all pretty much the same size. And what happened there was a New Zealander called Frank Kelf, was employed by the council and was just basically allowed to run wild. And he managed to get a load of funding over a two-year period and just planted trees everywhere. Plant a tree in 73, plant some more in 74. And so if you look, for example, outside the Arnolfini and look at the plane trees that are there, they'll give you exactly an idea of the size. And then you can start finding them everywhere, all over Bristol. So it's an incredible thing he did, and plane trees do grow fast, but it still takes 20, 30 years before they become substantial.
Yeah, one of the things that we've got on the Bristol Tree Forum website is a tree carbon calculator, and basically that's to tell us how long it would take for a tree that's been felled to be replaced by a tree that's just been planted. And generally speaking, it's in the region of 40 to 60 years. to actually recover the services and the benefits that a tree has. And of course, you can replace a tree, but what you can't replace is the time that that tree has taken to grow. And very often that could be 70, 80 years, or if you're talking about a very old oak, and there's certainly one up in on the Downs that I'm very familiar with, which is probably around about 530 years old. So some of these trees are very old. And of course, that is an enormously valuable tree because it's
a medieval tree.
It's a medieval tree. Yes, it was born round about the same time as Henry VIII.
Amazing that some of these things can carry on so long. In fact, I remember hearing about the yew tree, which is the most long-lived tree. That's why it was revered by the people in prehistoric society. Maybe you can say something about this, Martin. I don't know if you know anything about it at all. But being told on a site somewhere, I think it was on one of these hill forts, someone giving a guide saying the reason that you often find these planted in these sacred sites of various sorts and where humans were living back in those days is because they understood through various generations that these things lasted long, long time. And so they revered them in some sort of way, at least probably more than Bristol City Council seem to. We've also got the ongoing situation with a hedgerow being dug up at Yew Tree Farm. I don't know if either of you have been following that. That's been in the news this week.
Yes, we've both been very much involved in that.
Oh, yeah. Please, tell us about what's going on. Why is it important?
Well, what's happened in Yew Tree Farm is completely shocking. We've had, over the years, apparent political support for the retention of Bristol's last working farm. But due to some really bad decisions taken by the council, one of the nearby landowners basically has decided to remove a section of hedging. And despite the discovery of dormice, which are incredibly rare now, they're a highly protected species, the big machinery came in on probably one of the wettest days of the year, basically trashed the area all around the hedge, and the hedge itself was
thrashed. Hang on, these dormice don't sound very protected to me.
Well, they're only protected if a local authority gives them protection. And in this case, as usually happens, desperate phone calls were made, and no action was taken by the council, no action whatsoever. And it seems to us that that Redrow, who have an option on the land, are trying to degrade it to the extent that it no longer has any nature conservation value, and then they can argue it'll be fine to build houses on it.
So I suppose the idea is if we kill all the dormice, then there's no longer the chance of this being a wildlife or conservation area.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that a site of nature conservation interest does, it protects a site from development, but it doesn't protect it from anything else. So the farmers that are managing it, and the previous farmer managed it so well that's why it actually acquired the status of a site of nature conservation interest. But unfortunately, she's been removed from that, and another farmer is taking it over. And it looks to me as though probably what is happening is that land is being degraded to the point at which it is no longer part of the site of nature conservation interest. It will no longer be attributed as such, and then the developers can move in.
Well, I mean, this is the council's land, isn't it?
Well, it's actually a complicated story. So poor Yew Tree Farm is being attacked from one side by a commercial developer, and then on the other side, the council owns land which it had allowed Yew Tree Farm to use, but it's now expanding the cemetery and building lots of drainage pipes and what have you, again into an area of nature conservation interest, a site of nature conservation interest. And the cemetery proposal is flawed in all sorts of ways, partly because the land there is so wet and badly drained, But they're hoping to cure some of those problems by putting massive pipes into the ground and essentially losing some of the water into a stream nearby and putting attenuation ponds in and goodness knows what else. So they're turning a site of nature conservation interest into essentially an industrial area.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking. Your tree forum, if people are interested, do you meet face-to-face or are you one of these sort of people that do Zoom meetings only and occasionally would turn up at a council planning meeting, that sort of thing? So how do you operate?
Well, we do meet face-to-face. We have a relatively small committee made up of maybe six or seven people who meet on a regular basis. We have an AGM once a year where everyone is invited. And to be honest, you know, for our standard meetings, if anyone wanted to come and join us, they're perfectly happy to do so. We'd be very happy to welcome them along.
Well, come on, okay. Now's the hard-nosed sales pitch. Why should people get involved?
They get involved because they value trees. We're here basically to promote trees, to promote tree planting, to help retain trees, to educate people as to the benefits of trees. And we get involved in the politics, we get involved in campaigns. So anybody who's interested in trees, who thinks that trees are a good idea, and I'm sure most people do, should get in touch. We have a website, Bristol Tree Forum website, and we also have a sister website, which is the Trees of Bristol, which tells you everything you would ever want to know about pretty much every tree in Bristol. So go on to the website, but certainly get in touch with us, and if you want to be involved, we'd be happy for you to do so.
Okay, Vasily Papastavrou and John Tarleton from Bristol Tree Forum, thanks ever so much for joining us and also sharing your contact details and all that sort of thing, because I think it's just so wonderful that people like you are prepared to give your time up for something so important, which is something that the developers and many of the people at the City Council at the top anyway don't really seem to give a damn about. Martin, we're going to now go on and talk a bit about the shenanigans in Parliament this week. And on Wednesday, there was supposed to be a debate and discussion about Gaza. Actually, it was sort of presaged a bit beforehand by the Scottish National Party's Stephen Flynn bringing the whole topic up at Prime Minister's Questions midday Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I begin by echoing the sentiments of the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition in relation to the heroic bravery of Alexei Navalny. We all must continue to be united in our opposition to Vladimir Putin. Mr. Speaker, as it stands, some 60% of the buildings in Gaza are either damaged or destroyed. Much of the farmland is in ruin. Some 30,000 people are dead, 70,000 injured, and 1.4 million people are currently sheltering in Rafah, awaiting an imminent Israeli onslaught. Surely the Prime Minister must accept that that does not amount to self-defence.
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I share the concern of many members about the high rate of civilian casualties and indeed the growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and that is why we have called consistently for an immediate humanitarian pause, which would allow for the safe release of hostages and more aid going into Gaza so that we create the sustainable conditions for a long-term and enduring ceasefire. That is what our diplomatic efforts are focused on, and that is what I impressed upon the Israeli Prime Minister last week when I spoke to him.
Stephen Flynn.
Mr. Speaker, tonight this House will have the opportunity to join with the majority of the international community and say that enough is enough, that the killing in Gaza must stop and that the hostages must be released. And the best way to do that is to send a clear and united message that we back an immediate ceasefire. Surely all of us, irrespective of our political allegiance, can agree on that very issue.
Mr. Speaker, of course we want to see the fighting in Gaza end as soon as possible and never again allow Hamas to carry out the appalling terrorist attacks that Israel was subject to. But he talks about the UN resolution, but just calling for an immediate full ceasefire now, which collapses back into fighting within days or weeks, is not in anyone's interest, Mr. Speaker. We must work towards a permanent ceasefire, and that's why the right approach is the approach that we've set out and the United States have set out in their resolution, which is for an immediate humanitarian pause to get hostages out and aid in so that we then can create the conditions for a sustainable ceasefire. And in the meantime, we're doing everything we can to increase the amount of humanitarian aid that we bring into Gaza, something I discussed with the King of Jordan last week, and we will have more updates in the coming days of more airdrops into Gaza, but also just in the last couple of days have managed to deliver family tents into Gaza, which are providing much-needed shelter for very vulnerable people.
Right, so, you know, if we have a humanitarian pause, Martin, apparently the hostages are going to be released. Now, is that cloud cuckoo land?
Well, I mean, the underlying problem that we've got here is they won't accept Hamas as interlocutors. If you're going to have a ceasefire, that has to be agreed by both sides. And that means you've got to talk to Hamas. But the Israeli goal, claimed Israeli goal, is to destroy Hamas. That's not necessarily a viable goal, and it's not necessarily their real goal. But what is clear from what the right wing of the Israeli government are saying, and they're the dominant faction, is that their real goal is to expel the Palestinians completely. So when Western leaders like Sunak and Biden say, we want a permanent ceasefire, which means we've got to kill Hamas first, that is exactly what's wrong with the attitude. If we're going to have a ceasefire, any ceasefire would be good, but you've got to do it by negotiating with Hamas. And that means you've got to recognise Hamas, which means that the goal of smashing them, you've got to give it up. Actually, well, the real solution to this, and you saw what was happening, the Shawcross, who used to did the investigation into Prevent for the government. He said, he spoke up saying, we've got to look at all of the Hamas networks, in support networks in Britain, and they're a real threat. Britain made Hamas an illegal terrorist organisation about 3 or 4 years ago. Before that, it had not been it hadn't been called that. So I think the problem is that the West simply won't accept that Hamas have a legitimate right to what they do. I mean, the whole thing, oh, we've got to get rid of Hamas because they did terrible things on October the 7th. We've got to get rid of the State of Israel. They've done terrible things for 450 years. Ultimately, if you're not going to recognise Hamas, ultimately, other countries are going to say, well, we're not going to recognise Israel. If Hamas are terrorists, so were the Irgun in the 40s. And what did we do with them? We negotiated with them and we gave them a state. The idea that you can only have a ceasefire after Hamas have been eliminated is exactly the cause of the problem. They need to change that kind of thinking.
So we just go on, cycle on a little bit, and there were discussions taking place between Lindsay Hall, the Speaker, and Sir Keir Starmer about this. What did you make of this debacle this week, with the SNP walking out, the Conservatives also walking out of the debate and discussion? Lindsay Hoyle, really, it seems to me, what has been said about it, is that Starmer put pressure on him and said, look, if you allow our amendment, which shouldn't have been allowed, but if you do on the SNP's day, to do the debates and discussions, we'll make sure that you continue on. And he, of course, is actually a Labour MP. You can continue on as Speaker once we get elected at the end of this year.
Well, that's why a large number of SNP MPs and others have signed an early day motion of no confidence in him.
Yeah, but I mean, they're wasting their time, aren't they? If Starmer and the Israel lobby think that Lindsay Hall's the guy for the job and he's prepared to do things like this for them, then they'll keep him on, won't they?
That's quite likely, Tony. I think what was interesting was that the SNP had their go, and what Starmer was worried about, because he was definitely getting feedback, including from his own shadow cabinet, that they were definitely going to vote for the SNP's motion. So that's why he wanted to amend the motion, because otherwise he would face a massive split in his own party.
It's their motion, it's their day. Normally he's not allowed to do anything like that.
And of course, the Conservative government can try to amend an opposition motion, and they put their motion forward, which was also a way to try and box Starmer in, so that if there is to be an amended motion, I understand, it has to be from the government. So the government can oppose amendments. So when the Conservatives put their amendment in, that should definitely have taken precedence over a Labour amendment. Do you follow me? Yeah. I mean, there are no rules in Parliament, you see.
Well,
Tony.
Hang on. Okay. You say there are no rules, but there are also, there's this thing called precedent. If you're going to if you're going to give a debate day to the SNP, it should be their motion.
That's right. So that's what's caused all the fuss.
And interestingly, as part of that motion, is a very important phrase which makes war criminals shudder, and that is this term, collective punishment of the Palestinians, which is, in my mind, is that's exactly why there was so much effort put into to scuppering this discussion, scuppering this debate. Because that whole concept of collective punishment, Martin, is actually a war crime in legal terms, isn't
it? Of course it is.
To have the British Parliament pass that motion would have been rather nail-biting stuff for the Israelis.
Yes, and interestingly, what I was reading in The Guardian was that the Tories were worried that their MPs would vote for the SNP motion, that it might get passed. Now, just think about this. Britain is the little lapdog of the United States. If we are seen to be out of line with them, what would happen to our poor little country? But of course, all other members of the UN Security Council voted for the Algerian resolution this week, just as they voted for South Africa and other resolutions and all the rest. Britain is on its own here with the United States of America. One of the only two countries bombing Yemen.
A lot of the right-wing media, the Murdoch Empire particularly, have been crowing away all week saying, oh, it doesn't really matter, a motion like this. There's nothing we can really do about it. Actually, Britain is key in this, isn't it?
That's right. If Britain is a key player. And don't forget, the State of Israel was created because we invaded that area of the world in 1917 and imposed our will.
A tiny little thing called the Balfour Declaration, which I don't think was imposed by Germany or the United States. No, it was imposed by Britain.
That's right. So, I mean, from a local Palestinian point of view, we are definitely the bad guys. And, of course, we've not done much to disabuse them of that perception.
Keir Starmer made a big point yesterday of saying, I deny that there was any kind of offer made to the Speaker that he would be able to stay on or he was threatened in any way. Of course, you know, you don't believe anything until it's officially denied. But then he goes on to say something even more, which I found even more surprising and shocking, is that a few days before he had submitted this motion, this what you might call wrecking amendment, to the motion, he had been chit-chatting with none other than the Israeli president, Isaac Herzog.
What really happened is you were under massive pressure within your party to shift your position on a Gaza ceasefire, and if you hadn't secured that vote on that amendment, you'd have faced the biggest rebellion of your leadership.
The proposition I put on the table in that amendment was crafted by me after I came back from a Munich security conference, having spoken to Sir Christopher Blinken, having spoken to the Prime Minister of Qatar, having spoken to the President of Israel, i.e. having spoken to people who are actually involved in trying to wave all this awful conflict. I wanted that proposition heard and voted on, and my MPs wanted to vote on it. Happily, it was carried last night, and that's the right thing, but my focus is on what we need to do to resolve the awful situation going on in Gaza.
Okay, so
Kirsten,
thank you.
Yeah, so there he is saying, I've been talking to people directly involved in the conflict, like Isaac Herzog, President of Israel, and Antony Blinken, US Secretary of State.
And he also mentioned the Qatari foreign minister, but Qatar's position is immediate ceasefire. So obviously no notice what they were saying. Yeah, he's finessing this. Prime Minister Starmer, as he now sees himself, and he's pretty much a shoo-in, is now becoming Statesman Starmer, friend of the United States, friend of Israel. Is he talking to Hamas? Putin's talking to Hamas this week. Hamas and Fatah are going to Moscow for a confab with Putin. Is Sakir going to talk to Hamas? He ought to, really, because of the elected government of Palestine. They won the election in 2006. The reason why there hasn't been a subsequent election is not because Hamas didn't want one, it's because the Israelis wouldn't allow one in the West Bank. And they're trying to impose the current corrupt regime in the West Bank on Gaza after they've won the war, even though the right wing in Israel says there's going to be no Palestinian state, and in actual fact, we just want rid of all of these people. And the West is supplying, we are supplying weaponry for this genocide from Akrotiri in Cyprus. And the RAF are flying from Akrotiri in Cyprus over Israel, because I don't suppose they're going to be allowed to overfly Egypt, to bomb Yemen. And of course, the people in Cyprus, who people will remember this, in the 1950s, fought a guerrilla war against the British to kick us out, because we used to run Cyprus as well. And of course, they're very unhappy about their territory being used to bomb your men. But of course, ultimately, we are participants in the war against the Palestinians and the Yemenis, because we've been starving and murdering the Yemenis for the last 10 years with our Saudi allies. But Keir Starmer thinks it's respectable and responsible to be in bed with the Americans and the Israelis and carry on with all the shenanigans. That's not how they see it in Ireland, Tony.
I mean,
they're against anything. They know about the British. They've known about them for years and years.
As a rather pathetic smokescreen, what we've got is we've got Lindsay Hoyle saying, the Speaker saying, that he did this to protect the lives of MPs like David Amos and Joe Cox, who might be murdered by extremists outside the House of Commons. Now, outside the House of Commons that day, there was a pro-Palestine demonstration. It seems to be implying that these people are somehow threatening MPs, that they may kill MPs, which just seems absolute rubbish. And anyway, all he's trying to do is divert away from the fact that they don't want to have a resolution, a motion passed in the House of Commons, which condemns Israel's war crimes.
No, they don't. And it's a manipulation. And the Tory government put their wrecking amendment in to box Starmer in. But then, of course, they're not... I think most of the complainants, I'll have to look at it up on the website, who's actually complaining about Lindsay Hoyle. It's overwhelmingly the SNP, I think, and various other people. I'll have to check on what who exactly is discommoded by this. But, I mean, the whole thing is a stitch-up by the British establishment so that we can carry on being muttley to America's Dick Dastardly. And that's what sovereignty means in this country today.
Actually,
we're
the
going
thing
to
is,
war in Yemen for a cause which most people in this country are actually... The majority of opinion is quite clearly in favour of an immediate ceasefire in this country.
I'm not sure about your Dick Dastardly motif there, because Muttley actually didn't really like Dick Dastardly at all, did
well,
he?
Well, I'm British and I don't like Dick Dastardly at all, I have to admit.
Everything that goes wrong for the Americans, you get a little...
Yes.
In the background.
Well, indeed.
But anyway, in the reality, there is actually quite a lot of doctors in Bristol of various sorts, and nurses are going out volunteering and getting paid, actually, by Médecins Sans Frontières. It's a very, very great organisation. Please, folks, do feel free to donate to them, as well as maybe other charities. Nice to see, finally, the UNICEF Gaza adverts popping up on our TV screens after, 4 months now. But one of the local doctors here that went over to help, he's a Bristol emergency medicine doctor, and he had this to say about what was going on over in Gaza last night.
There is no safe space, truly. This is something we were told as we went into Gaza, was the mantra. There is no safe space in Gaza. That is true for everyone. And I think all healthcare workers, as we've seen most recently in Nasser Hospital, it happened in Shifa, it happened in Al Alba, it's happened in Al Aqsa Hospital in the middle area. There is no safe place to provide healthcare for anyone. Everywhere is a risk. So who is still there and what are they doing? There are amazing people like this. Some of you may recognise this guy. This is Dr. Ahmed Mograbi, who is very popular on Instagram. He rages against the world on a regular basis. He's a very skilled plastic surgeon. And he ran the burns unit at Nasser Hospital, where MSF had worked before. So I didn't know him before I went, but knew the burns unit in Nasser Hospital, so we went and started working with him. This is him now, living in the corridors, essentially outside of his burns unit that he used to run with his family. This is the daughter of another family member who was killed, who his family have adopted. So this is what his daily life is. He wakes up in his corridor, outside his burns unit, with his family all around him, a few bits and bobs trying to keep them going. And he goes to work, and he works every day. You would have seen he left Nasser Hospital at the very last moment on his way out of the checkpoint. He's put a video on recently explaining how he went through, and one of our other colleagues, Rami, the nurse, head nurse of the burns unit, was taken captive. These people stayed in Nasser Hospital providing healthcare till the bitter end, we could say. And what were they facing? I mean, wounds like we've never encountered. This guy doing plastic surgery, highly skilled, having to live like this, but every day walking across the compound to come and do amazingly skilled surgery. But what did he face? What do you do with that? this is part of daily experience of this poor man. Not only is he displaced, he's lost, his house was destroyed, his place, he had a private business doing some plastic surgery on the side, that has gone. He's living in a hospital corridor, and every day he gets up and goes to work and faces this. This is what they're dealing with every single day.
What is it? I can't believe that.
He's been exploded.
Is that a child?
Yeah, yeah. The one thing I took away from it was when I was there, and about 3 or 4 weeks in, I had a conversation with one of the UN team who are doing stuff I've never seen. Without the UN, this would be far worse. They are an incredible organisation in Gaza, doing amazing things. And I sort of felt a bit down and said, like, what we're doing, like, you know, we're peeing into the sea with this, aren't we? We're not doing anything here. What can we achieve? And they replied, she replied, all we can do is keep showing that we will not give up. We will not give up. The world has not forgotten you. The world will not give up. So thank you for coming tonight, because I think that's what that shows, is the world is not forgetting. We're not giving up. And as bad as it all is, that's what we've got to do, is just try and keep going and keep trying to help these poor people.
Okay, that's one of the emergency doctors in Bristol who's been working out in Gaza, Martin. Several things he brings up there. This whole concept of it's so important to be there to send a message that people are not going to give up.
I think that's right. This is the cause célèbre of our time. This is like the Spanish Civil War. This is like Guernica. This is like if we walk by on the other side of the road here. You remember the Manic Street Preachers song? If you tolerate this, then your children will be next, which was a slogan of the 1930s. And this is that moment.
He's also saying, talking there about, I mean, obviously, you know, you can't see the slides. I did see the slides. There was a gasp of amazement in the audience when he showed the emergency room where several people were being brought in to be laid on the floor. There was just simply nowhere to put them. And that what they'd done is in the emergency room, they just had to clear the floor. There were no beds, no tables, nothing. And so you see pictures of the nurses and the doctors actually sometimes literally doing immediate operations on people, maybe not quite so complex operations, but anyway, just literally on their knees next to them.
Well, the Israelis have deliberately targeted hospitals. They've targeted everything. They're trying to just bomb everything. But the hospitals were deliberately targeted because there is a genocidal intent, as the South Africans, to my mind, proved at the International Court of Justice. That's why they go for hospitals. That means they'll get the biggest casualty figures they can possibly get. And as far as the Israelis are concerned, the more Palestinians that die, the better.
And he's talking
and
about
some of them have openly said so, which is what the South Africans pointed out. They're saying that they're going to murder them all. Why do you believe them? Why don't you believe them when they say that?
Yes, well, Rishi Sunak doesn't seem to. Keir Starmer doesn't seem to. They've been better advised by Blinken and Herzog. Another thing that he talks about there, which I found fascinatingly enlightening, you know, to get somebody who's actually just been there and just come back to the UK, I think is incredibly valuable. And what he's saying is that one of his fellow staff, the guy, the plastic surgeon guy, he's a little bit wiser than one of the nursing staff, because they realise as soon as what the Israelis announce is that we're going through looking for Hamas, as soon as these Israeli soldiers arrive on the scene, everybody has to leave because they know that they may be detained immediately by these soldiers. So that means as soon as the Israeli soldiers arrive, they're not looking for Hamas. What they're doing is they're making sure all of the staff are forced to leave. And of course, he did leave and he managed to keep his liberty. But some of the staff that stayed, even for just a few minutes, were then detained by the Israelis and taken back to prison.
Well, I remember reading not long ago about
they're probably Hamas fighters in disguise.
Well, what happened recently is somebody who was working in a hospital in some capacity was sent into the hospital to tell everybody to get out because the Israelis were coming in. They then started to leave the hospital through a so-called, you know, corridor that they could do, and they were all shot dead by snipers, including the guy they'd sent in to talk to them. Now, it's pretty clear that the actual operation of the Israeli forces is genocidal in its intent. They're not just killing its civilians by accident. They're killing them quite deliberately. There's been finding mass graves with people with shot through the head, hands tied. This is all the sort of thing that the Russian army was supposed to have done at Bucha, although in actual fact it wasn't them. It was probably the Ukrainian SBU. But nevertheless, this is a far, far worse war crime than anything that's happened in the Ukraine on either side. And nevertheless, we can't have any sanctions on Israel, because that would be anti-Semitic. Although, interestingly enough, both France and Spain are suggesting that the EU needs to look at its trade treaties with Israel. Yeah? Why does the EU...
Why don't they tear them up? Don't look at them. Just tear them up now.
Well, exactly. But the point is, the question is, when are we going... If we can't do anything else, what we could do with our base in Akrotiri in Cyprus, Tony, probably one of the biggest RAF bases in the world, we could put a no-fly zone in over Gaza.
Well, what they have
we put
been,
one in over Libya. We put one in over Iraq.
Rishi Sunak was hinting something that happened yesterday, which was that the British got together with the Jordanians to drop essential medical supplies into northern Gaza, because it's proving almost impossible to get aid convoys up to northern Gaza. So using a Jordanian Air Force Hercules aircraft, they're just chucking the aid out on big pallets and parachutes out the back of the plane. They're flying over the top of Gaza to drop it in.
Well, that's basically
It's PR.
But I mean, in terms of, at the same time, we're still supplying weaponry to the Israelis who are bombing Gaza. I mean, how can you bring aid in without a ceasefire? It doesn't make sense. And we can't have a ceasefire because we can't have a ceasefire until Hamas has been defeated. But that starts from the presumption that we've got to defeat Hamas. We don't have to defeat Hamas. We don't have to defeat Ansar Allah either. They're not our enemies.
Killing Palestinians with one hand and then, you know, throwing a few sticky plasters to them with the other.
Well, it's in Apocalypse Now, isn't he? He said it's just a lie, the hero. Martin Sheen, you massacre somebody with a machine gun and then you throw him a band-aid, because the band-aid is not for them, it's for you, to make you think that you did your best.
Anyway, we've got a couple of commentators now. One is the Bristol Pakistan Society's Farooq Siddiq, and newly actually, he's a very busy chap these days. He also owns a restaurant in Clifton. I think it's called The Palms, which we'll have to try and check out at some point, because he's such a brilliant guy. I mean, he's been going here in Bristol for a long time. Do you want to say something about Farooq, Martin? Because I think it was the Muslim Cultural Society we first came across him during 9/11.
Well, he's been around in Bristol for a long time. He's a very respected member of the Muslim community, and we've had him on this show. But I didn't know he ran a restaurant. But they...
No, this is only a very recent change.
Oh, right, so it's a new thing.
It's a recent thing. But also we're going to be hearing from Vanessa Bealey, who's a freelance journalist now based in Damascus. Absolutely brilliant to hear from her. She's someone who's, I think it's her father, was ambassador to Egypt. And so I actually began by asking her about the whole role of Egypt in all of this. Obviously, the Rafah crossing is, which is where the, and the town of Rafah, just inside Gaza, is where the Israelis are threatening now. I mean, this is just appalling. In fact, do you want to say something about that this week, Martin? The Israelis are saying, unless you deliver up all the hostages and ceasefire, we are going to start carpet bombing Rafah the holy month of Ramadan starts.
Well, I mean, the Rafah crossing...
This is really evil, isn't it? So this is the holy month of Ramadan. So instead of helping out on the holy month of Ramadan, maybe a ceasefire or something, the Israelis say, actually, we're going to start carpet bombing you.
Well, they say they're going to do it. I mean, they already are bombing and attacking. So the idea that they're not attacking Rafah is wrong.
They've told everyone to go there.
But they've carried on attacking. Because, as I say, the policy really is to kill as many Palestinians as possible.
And they lie, and they lie. And anyway, let's have a listen now to Vanessa Bealey and with her take on Egypt.
Since the demise of Nasser, really, Egypt has been... betraying, really, the Palestinian cause with the Camp David agreement in 79. Some would argue that Sadat betrayed Syria in the 1973 October War, or Yom Kippur War, as Israel calls it. And I mentioned early on the 2005 Philadelphia Accord, which is considered by Israel to be an extension of the Camp David agreement, and basically gives them control of the strip of land, or rather, I suppose it can be called a buffer zone, between Gaza and Egyptian Rafah. And since 2013, Egypt has been systematically destroying Egyptian Rafah, displacing the Bedouin inhabitants. There have been reports recently that Egypt has denied, but then, you know, I tend to take any Egyptian denial with a very large pinch of salt. There have been satellite images and video footage of Egyptian construction workers and bulldozers clearing an area on the border with Gaza, Rafah, but close to the Kerem Shalom Israeli-controlled border, really creating what looks like another open-air prison. Ever since, they've been speaking about the Rafah operation. And I also have to say, I mean, this continuous sort of lip service by Western governments against military operations in Rafah, while military operations in Rafah are ongoing. You know, they're being bombed east, west, north, south of Rafah, despite Rafah having been presented as a safe area. And Palestinians can't go anywhere else. They can only head back into central Gaza, where they're already being bombed. And now I think there was a report in the Wall Street Journal that the Israeli forces have created really a border between south and north Gaza, where there's 700,000 people still suffering famine conditions in northern Gaza. And so they will divide completely southern Gaza from Gaza City down from northern Gaza. And as you said, you know, Egypt has done nothing. It's the queues of humanitarian aid outside the Rafah crossing. Egypt has not allowed it in. I saw an interview with the health minister saying that, you know, Egyptian hospitals were ready to accept Palestinian injured, including children. But it's and then he said something extraordinary, whereas he said it's not our territory. We don't control who can exit. But they do. There's a guy called Ibrahim al-Arjani, who's very close to President Sisi and his son. He has various business interests with Sisi's son, and he controls the Rafah border. He belongs to one of the tribal factions in the Sinai. He has all of the construction contracts on the Egyptian side, but also in agreement with Israel in Gaza itself in 2021. And he controls, as I said, the Rafah crossing. The Rafah crossing is charging $5,000 for any adult that wants to cross to safety in Egypt, and $2,500 for any child, even if that child is injured and in desperate need of medical care. Egypt is charging them to leave. You know, Egypt effectively is increasing the pressure and the abuse of the Palestinians, and also offering, despite its protestations that it isn't and that it doesn't want Palestinians in the Sinai. In my view, this has been planned for years, since 2014, even before.
So that's Vanessa Bealey out in Damascus speaking to me earlier this week. Martin, I mean, it's pretty shocking that this really does seem to be a joint operation between Tel Aviv and Cairo, actually, doesn't it?
Well, don't forget that the regime in Cairo is essentially the Egyptian army rather than an elected government. There was an elected government, which was led by Mohamed Morsi, and they, of course, he was the leader of
the Muslim Brotherhood,
which, of course, Hamas is affiliated with. So the anti-Muslim Brotherhood forces within Egypt, and they're quite strong. The Muslim Brotherhood is by no means the dominant faction.
Well, it's all of the real activists from the Muslim Brotherhood, after Sisi was arrested, after he died, I think it was in prison, whilst he was having a trial. What happened was all of the activists from the Muslim Brotherhood were, many of them were executed. They were all arrested.
Yes.
Some of them are still in prison. So the idea of allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to thrive in Egypt was really a ruse to get these people to admit to who they were, the fact that they were actually a much more legitimate and normal government, even if there's, to a certain extent, the Muslim Brotherhood is manipulated by the West, in order to find out who they were and execute them.
That's right. And of course, there's no demand for an uprising in Egypt at the moment from the Western powers, because they've got exactly what they want. They've got a government that's going to do exactly what they want and play ball with the Israelis to destroy the Palestinians. And that's not because it represents the Egyptian people. It doesn't. People in Egypt are horrified by this. Their government is doing this. What the Egyptian army could have done, and in a previous era they would have done, is they'd have gone to war with Israel here. We've got we've got all this army. It's a huge amount of our public expenditure goes on having an army in Egypt. And what do we use it for? Nothing. If it's there, why don't you use it and attack the Israelis? Egyptians could easily put a no-fly zone in over Gaza. They'd have to fight the Israeli army, but there you are.
There is a chap that looks actually a little bit like, with lighter coloured hair, George Monbiot, for some reason. His name is Zev Jabotinsky. She's Vanessa started. I was asking her about, the sort of political influences behind Netanyahu. So she mentioned this guy, Zev Jabotinsky, who's one of the original Zionists. Who is this chap?
Well, he was originally born in Belarus. And he was one of he was very, very clear from the get-go that his version of Zionism would need to the elimination of the Palestinians. Some of them are more mealy-mouthed about it. He was, we're going to have to get rid of them.
He just looks like Monbiot. It should be. It's a bit cruel of me to say he does actually just look like him. He's got that kind of slight scowly face. He co-founded this thing called the Jewish Legion of the British Army in World War One.
Yes, so World War One? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, in other words, Jabotinsky, he was one of the, he's one of the early Zionists.
But he's founder of the Irgun as well.
Yes, that's right. So in other words, he is the one, he also lived in Italy for a while and was very pally with Mussolini. So they modelled themselves upon the Italian fascists. And as Ken Livingstone pointed out to his great, to the end of his political career, the right wing in Israel did cooperate with the Nazis, and in fact Jabotinsky made overtures to Hitler to, do you want us to fight the British for you and give us a state in Israel? And of course they carried on fighting against the British even while the Eighth Army was fighting in the Western Desert.
Anyway,
that was their attitude.
Let's have a listen now to what Vanessa Beeney makes of this guy's influence on Netanyahu.
If you look at the map of Greater Israel, 70% of Syria, 50% of Saudi Arabia, most of Jordan, as you said. And I think, if you look at Netanyahu, he's a follower of Jabotinsky, who was one of the early founders of Zionism. But it's known as revisionist Zionism, which is very much an expansionist Zionism. So in other words, yes, the Greater Israel plan is very much at the forefront of his mind, as it is at the forefront of the majority of his right-wing coalition colleagues. And if we look at Jabotinsky, you mentioned, far right-wing Nazi extremists, and much of the policy that we're seeing against Palestinians right now can be very easily compared to Nazi operations and tactics against not only Jews, but against communists and against Romanies, etc. But if you look at Jabotinsky himself, in the early 1920s, I think it was 1923, he actually formed an alliance in the Republic of Ukraine with the then first president, Simon Petlura, who had carried out pogroms against Jews. Yet Jabotinsky was happy to form an alliance with him very much on a secular basis in order to push back against what was perceived as the communist threat from the Soviet Union. And as I said, Netanyahu is a follower, as his father was and his grandfather was before him, of Jabotinsky. And so that kind of demonstrates this adherence to what is a non-religious, white supremacist, racist ideology, right, which is very secular. And if you look at the current Zionist coalition regime and how many of them didn't come from the region but came from countries like Ukraine, like Bosnia, the majority are from those kind of, I guess, Balkan areas, Eastern European areas, many of them from Ukraine. And the connections to Ukraine go back also years. Golda Meir was born in Kiev. Huge numbers of Israeli leadership and military commands were born in Ukraine. Chabad Lubavitch is based in Ukraine. Kolomoisky, who put Zelensky into power, has an Israeli passport. So the connection with Ukraine is very strong. And the connection to that kind of, as I said, white supremacist ideology, the Nazi Aryan race ideology, is also very prevalent, as you said, in Netanyahu himself, but also in the government. And that's why we've seen these incredible statements that were picked up by South Africa in their case at the ICJ. I mean, I think there's a website called Law for Palestine, and I think they've recorded more than 500 such statements, which is extraordinary.
So that's Vanessa Bealey. The full interview will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, and of course on the app with a new wonderful little shuttle device you can use to shuttle backwards and forwards if you want, and through the interviews. If you find a bit boring, then you can go zipping a little bit for, you know, sort of, I don't know, whatever, 15 seconds or 20 seconds or half a minute forward. I'm sure you won't be finding that one boring at all. Fascinating stuff from Vanessa, really drilling down in some of the main issues. But Martin, this connection with the Nazis is pretty disturbing, isn't it? Actually, it's almost the one thing you're not allowed to talk about, and particularly with Ukraine.
Well, I mean, this Thierry Masson's Voltaire.net website has some very good articles about the history of right-wing Zionism. And in actual fact, they didn't just have alliances of convenience with the far right in Europe. They were in cahoots with them. Don't forget, if you are a Zionist, the idea is that you make Jews terrified to live anywhere else except Israel. The fundamental ideology of Zionism is that Jews cannot be safe anywhere except Israel.
Yeah, but a lot of Jews in Israel are now thinking, gosh, is it really safe here?
Well, that's right. It's a bit of a contradiction, isn't it? You might think people would be much better off living where they are, minding their own business and just getting on with family life. But there you go. That might be traditional Jewish values for you. That's not Zionist values, is it?
What about Lubavitch and Kolomoisky? I know you talked a lot about Kolomoisky when Zelensky was first elected, didn't you?
Well, Kolomoisky was born in the Ukraine, so but of course he's got the right to Israeli citizenship because he's got Jewish heritage.
Is this the Israeli mafia?
Oh, he's definitely mafia, and he lives in Israel, so draw your own conclusions. He's gone to Israel.
Well, look, hang on, Ukraine is a war zone. Quite obviously, if things turn a bit nasty, he can just hop on a plane or whatever and get himself down to Israel. He's got his Israeli passport,
well,
too.
Well, that's fairly common anyway. Don't forget that you've got a lot of people from the former Soviet Union living in Israel because they've got the right to go there. They've just got the right to go there. They don't have to get into a rubber dinghy. They can just say, I'm Jewish and I want to come to Israel, and they can go. And, of course, the mafia in Russia and Ukraine, many of them are Jewish. They always have dual Israeli Russian citizenship or Ukrainian citizenship. So, with Kolomoisky, he was basically he's got various court cases and stuff against him. So that's why he's disappeared off the scene. Also, of course, it's because Zelensky, his little puppet, has been taken over by the Western intelligence services. Kolomoisky, and I've mentioned this on RT some years ago, Kolomoisky was starting to talk in terms of, we probably need to make peace with Putin. That's why he had to be removed, because he was the sort of person, I mean, Zelensky was his protege. So if Kolomoisky thinks we've got to make peace with Putin, then that's very dangerous for the people who don't want peace with Putin. And that's not necessarily just the right wing in Ukraine. It's the deep state manipulators in the West, including MI6 and the British. The British are not good actors in any of this. Our role as a state has been particularly vicious and unpleasant, and it embitters me to think that that is my country involved in that kind of manipulation.
But Vanessa also brought up this thing, Shabad Lubavitch, which I'm not really familiar with. Do you know anything about that?
Well, they're more... I think he's...
It's a dynasty, apparently.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure, but I think they are a very extreme Zionist religious sect. So you've got this confluence now between secular Zionists like Jabotinsky, who basically... You know, they were nationalist in a very bizarre, radical form. But of course, you've now got religious Zionists who are in the government of Israel, who also believe in the end times, and this is God's will that they're fulfilling, and all the rest of it. And they've got nuclear weapons. Isn't that kind of sort of?
Well, Chabad, you know, is also known as Chabad Lubavitch. Is also known as Chabad Lubavitch. One of the world's best-known Hasidic movements. What does that mean?
Well, it's a strain of Orthodox Judaism.
Judaism. One of the largest Hasidic groups, as well as one of the largest Jewish religious organizations in the world. Unlike most Haredi groups, which are self-segregating, Chabad mainly operates in the wider world as it caters to secularized Jews. So she's absolutely right, isn't she? She's pinning this on some of these supposedly Orthodox organizations or Jewish organizations that actually are largely secular.
Yes, and as you know, Tony, there are certain sects of Orthodox Jews who do not accept the State of Israel because they see it as blasphemous, because they see it as a secularization of what should be regarded as a spiritual matter.
It's ambiguous, isn't it, the idea that this is a secular organization for Jews?
Well, indeed. I mean, and of course, how do you define a Jew? And you end up doing like they did in Nazi Germany. It depends upon your ancestry. You know, I mean, you couldn't get more racist, could you, really? It's a mirror image of Nazi purity laws.
Apparently it was suppressed in Russia, but then became more resurgent. But most definitely it is. Philosophy focuses on religious and spiritual concepts such as God, the soul, the meaning of the Jewish commandments, classical Judaic writings, and Jewish mysticism, especially the Zohar and the Kabbalah of Rabbi Isa Luria. Well, we'll be hearing from... he's not the world's greatest fan of Kabbalah. Neither am I, of course. This whole idea of religious mysticism is, seems to me, quite obviously... Well, some people think it's cool, it's interesting, it's fascinating, the Gnostics, whatever. But actually what it is, it's an attempt to hijack the faith and hijack the religion. So it's hardly surprising that they're aiming a lot of what they do, the Lubavitch people, at the secular part of society. So they're saying, well, you don't need to believe in God, but here's what God's telling you, and it's what makes you Jewish. So fascinating. Thank you ever so much for that, Vanessa Bealey. And like I say, on thisweek.org.uk, later tonight we'll have the full version of that if you want to listen to all the stuff. She took us through some fascinating areas, I think. I asked her about lots of the countries, including Turkey nearby. What's their interest? What's their role? And of course, since she's in Damascus, I had to ask her also about what's going on in Syria, in northern Syria, with all the various factions battling still away in there. But the other person I spoke to this week about Gaza specifically is Farouk Siddiq from the Bristol Muslim Cultural Society.
Pakistan Association now, isn't he?
Oh, right, sorry. Bristol Pakistan Association. Thanks, Martin, for correcting me. And the restaurant, The Palms. Sounds great. It sounds lovely, doesn't it? So anyway, Farouk had this to say. I mean, he's one of the most vocal people, I think, in the city. He's been paying a great deal of attention to the horrors in Gaza. And we'll be hearing a little while from Farouk before the break about what's been going on in Pakistan with Imran Khan and the Pakistani elections. But first, Gaza.
This is an ethnic cleansing on an industrial scale, and I've never seen the likes of it. If you look at the video, and the pictures coming out of northern Gaza, there's nothing left of it. It's just rubble, flattened, and now bulldozers are going there, flattening it. They're literally just flattening the whole area. There's nothing to go back to. People, even if Israel tomorrow turns around and says, you know what, we'll give you a ceasefire, and they tell Israel, yeah, they can go back. Go back to what? They've destroyed the hospitals, they've destroyed the schools, they've destroyed the roads, they've destroyed the buildings where people live, they've destroyed the power centers, they've destroyed the water supplies. There's nothing for people This is ethnic cleansing on an industrial scale done by the people that suffered the most in World War II. It's unimaginable, the utter frustration and the utter devastation. It was done to them, the same media, the same dehumanization, the same animals, the word abuse of animals, we're going to kill them, proudly dancing in joy at the destruction that they're heaping on Gaza. The one girl, Rajab, young lady, 5 years old, she was killed being in a car with her family, and an Israeli truck, tank, whatever you want to call it, came up alongside, saw the family inside the car, and started shooting bullets into it, killed everyone except that one girl in the back of the car. She called the Islamic Red Cross. She called them. There's phone call records, evidence. The family called them before they started getting shot. You can hear them being getting shot. She calls the Islamic Red Crescent, this girl, after all her family's been killed, and she says, I'm alone, they've killed my family, I went myself, please come and save me. And then you hear her being shot. This is happening to one family. It's happened. Entire families have been wiped from the face of this earth. There's no one left from that family. That generation is gone. Literally wiped out. They're destroying cemeteries. What? You're not letting people live, but you're not letting the rest dead. The dead rest. The Israeli army is digging up cemeteries in Gaza. They're literally wiping everything out. And it's not surprising. Their political leadership are saying exactly what their soldiers are doing. And the evidence is piling up. And our media in the West, what our media is saying, oh, how can we have such a breakdown of discipline in the Israeli army? What are you talking about? It's not a breakdown of discipline. They've been told to do this. They're following orders. It's not a breakdown of discipline when they're smashing up people's homes, when they're urinating on dead bodies, when they're taking pictures next to dead corpses. They are sharing that with glee. They're sharing what we're going to do. They sing songs about it around the campfires, what we are doing in Gaza, what we won't do. We're going to kill every single one. And who's saying that to them? The Israeli politicians. Their president is saying it to them. Their prime minister is saying it to them. Their foreign minister is saying it to them. Their home minister is saying it to them. In open, Benny Gantz, the defense minister, you know what he said? And it's hardly reported by the Western media. He said, I have lifted all restraints on the Israeli army. That is chilling. What does that mean? It's just that one sentence, but what does that mean? He's basically telling his army, do what you want. Do you know the chief rabbi for the Israeli army? The chief rabbi that gives spiritual and religious counseling and guidance to the Israeli army? He says that it's okay for the Israeli soldiers to rape during times of war. To rape non-Jews during times of war. He's now the head of the Israeli, he's a general. He's the head of the Israeli religious services, the army's religious services. This is what we've got. Hardly, and it's covered, it's fig-leafed by the Western media.
That's the Pakistan Society, Bristol Pakistan Society's Farouk Siddiq speaking to me earlier this week, Martin. And I mean, it's quite clear. One of the things he was saying was that actually in Pakistan, particularly, as it's a Muslim country, I suppose, is they really are getting some coverage, the sort of thing that the Qataris and Al Jazeera would balk at.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, people in the West think they are being given a kind of comprehensive view of the world when they switch on the BBC or ITV at 6 o'clock or whatever, and it just isn't. There's loads of things that they're not being told. Mostly censorship works not by stopping people saying things, it's just by making sure they're never said, and also by the framing that we use. So, you know, the Hamas hold hostages, but the Israelis have prisoners. Now, in actual fact, most of the prisoners that the Israelis are holding are, in fact, hostages. There's been no legal process against them. Marwan Barghouti, who's probably most people have never heard of him, but he's probably considered by those in the know to be the potential Nelson Mandela for the Palestinians. And he rots in prison because he's been put there by the Israelis. He didn't do anything from his own point of view. From their point of view, he's a terrorist leader, blah-de-blah-de-blah. And the West, the Israelis get a free ride all the time about being a democratic state, and they wouldn't do this and they wouldn't do that. Meanwhile, they are engaged in all of the atrocities that Farouk was explaining there. And, you know, the West, as I was saying earlier in the show, the whole idea that Hamas must be eliminated and that's the problem. And if we could only get rid of Hamas, everybody could live in peace. That's A, rubbish, and B, it's also disgusting and insulting. Hamas are the democratically elected government of their country, just as if the Nazis had invaded this country in the 1940s, we would have expected to fight back exactly as Hamas is fighting back. And people might have said, well, we don't want the suffering, we don't want the struggle, but we voted for this government and we're going to back them and we're going to fight. And it looks like that the political support for Hamas within the Palestinian community, insofar as anybody can ascertain it now, is getting stronger and stronger. Stronger and stronger. And all they've got big families in Palestine, and all those little boys and girls that are growing up to be warriors.
Well, what we're coming towards after the break is this week's Julian Assange hearings. Got some of the speeches from that. Obviously, there's nothing really to come out of that until we get the judgment in a couple of weeks' time. But obviously, there was an enormous concentration over Tuesday and Wednesday this week in London. Would have loved to have been there, actually, but had the flu. Don't normally make it down for those things anyhow, but feeling a lot better this week. And so we're going to hear now from, and all of this in a way where we're talking about Gaza or Pakistan, almost anywhere, Ukraine, it all kind of hinges on the press in a way, Martin, doesn't it? The way that the public are misinformed, and as you say, well, they don't know if we don't tell them.
That's right. I mean, Julian Assange famously said, if wars are started by lies, peace will be brought about by telling the truth. And I think that's a pretty accurate assessment.
Well, the truth in Pakistan is that Imran Khan has won, even though he's in prison, and all sorts of various methods were used in order to try and stop him winning, including, as Farouk Sadiq explained to me earlier this week, the cricket bat that people used to vote for his party, was taken off the ballot sheet. So, because there's many people who are illiterate and couldn't read otherwise which party the candidate was for. But anyway, he still managed to win those elections. So here's Farouk's take on the last week's elections in Pakistan, where Imran Khan, who's been basically taken out by the Americans by bribing politicians in the country to pass this motion of no confidence in him. And now what's happening is lawfare. And we'll be hearing after the break a bit about Donald Trump too. This is something, Martin, which we'll be talking about in a minute before the break. But this whole idea of using the legal system to nobble people.
The process started against Imran Khan, which was to remove him from power. He was the prime minister at the time. No confidence motion. That was started by the opposition, tabled literally 2 days after the American Undersecretary of State, Donald Liu, told the opposition and the army to remove Imran Khan. And he specifically says in that letter, reported by the ambassador of Pakistan in America, that it specifically said that the no confidence motion in the Pakistani parliament must succeed. If it succeeds, then we'll forgive your issues, the Pakistani military. At that stage, there was no confidence motion in Pakistan. The parliament had not been tabled. So this was 2 days before no confidence motion was tabled against Imran Khan. It was tabled. Imran Khan lost that no confidence motion by all of the opposition, which despised each other up to that point, couldn't sit around the same table as each other up to that point. The only thing that united them was Imran Khan, their opposition to Imran Khan in their own way. And this opposition had literally said to each other that, I'm going to drag you through the streets, I'm going to wipe out you, or I'm going to drag the money you stole from the country. So these are the kinds of conversations that the opposition was having amongst itself, accusing each other. And then suddenly, 2 days after Donald Liu's proclamation, they all unite, unheard of, never done before. They've tabled a no confidence motion, which has never succeeded in Pakistani history, never. And Imran Khan was ousted as prime minister. And in the end, he became more powerful once he was ousted. And you have a system in place right now where the government, the establishment, a euphemism for the military, has decided it's going to use the opposition again to form the same kind of coalition government that they did when they ousted Imran Khan, and see how that goes. And that's where we are. And unfortunately, it doesn't bode well for the country.
No, it certainly doesn't. Martin, it's very interesting. I find, you know, similarities with Egypt, actually. The idea is that actually the local military are just literally agents of the CIA who do as they're told by the Americans nowadays. Now, Khan has been sidelined.
Well, it was true in Latin America for years and years and years.
This is just colonialism, really.
Sorry?
Colonialism.
Of course it is. I mean, it's becoming clear. What's happened in Gaza is that we're coming back to talking about things by their proper names. This is colonialist imperialism. And, of course, the third world countries, which have been on the receiving end of this for 500 years, and that includes the Chinese, for example. You know, China was basically wrecked by the British. They've pulled back out of it. They've managed to turn their country into quite a success story. But it's no thanks to us. And no thanks to us in Africa, no thanks to us in India, no thanks to us in the Middle East, and no thanks to our American friends in Latin America.
You can understand the Americans are a bit nervous since the Pakistanis have got nuclear weapons, which I talked to Farouk about. Yeah, so, you know, that's nuclear weapons.
The nuclear weapons, that's another issue. Who gets to have nuclear weapons and on what basis? And
well, the
are
Indians
they usable?
Got them, so the Pakistanis have to have them.
Well, the Pakistanis felt they had to have them because the Indians have got them. That's right.
Yeah, so what do you make of what's going to happen now in Pakistan? The idea is now it's just going to be controlled by the army?
The army have pretty much got what they want, sadly, because what they've done is Imran Khan's party wasn't allowed to stand as a party. So they all had to stand as independents, and they, as you say, they took the cricket bat symbol off the ballot paper. Don't forget, 40% of the Pakistani population is illiterate. Of course, it was a British colony for years and years and years, and 40% of the population are illiterate. Why do you think that is, Tony? Surely we helped them to learn to read, except we didn't. So both in India and Pakistan, it's very important to have symbols that people can recognise who are illiterate. So that by removing that symbol, that really undermines the PTI party, or what it's called. And also, of course, the whole thing was basically rigged. So they're allowed to get some people elected, and they upset the army by being the largest single party. But they've now got everybody else to gang up on them, with the army behind the new regime, the Americans behind the army, and Imran Khan probably in prison for the rest of his life, and he's going to die soon because he's being ill-treated. Younger people in Pakistan, as Farouk will tell you, are extremely angry and fed up with everything that's been going on over the years.
Okay, before the break,
the older generation this is the product of our colonial history, not just Pakistan's.
Well, it most certainly is, and particularly here, it's the United States, actually. But Indian farmers have been protesting. This is our last item before the break. I think we may as well look over there. But what do you make of Modi, Martin?
Well, Modi is there's an election coming up in India. It's likely he will win. Did you see? He was boasting and the big TV show of opening this new Hindu temple at Ayodhya, yeah, which has been based on a 16th century mosque was bulldozed out of the way to build it.
Well, it was pretty much derelict, actually.
Well, but the point is, it didn't belong to them, and it's not. The point of this is,
there were thousands of people killed in riots over that.
That's
actually,
right.
But is it in the 1980s or something?
Yes, that's right. This is Modi's history.
Yeah,
he's stirring up communal tension in India.
So, is he a Hindu nationalist? Is that right?
Of course he is. Yeah. He's a Hindu nationalist. Does he have popular support? Well, sadly, he does. But he's not necessarily, you know, he may be re-elected, but there'll be still opposition forces
to him. I suppose cynical might say that Mountbatten left that whole India-Pakistan situation to smoulder after he died, didn't he?
Well, I mean, the whole problem is that Britain shouldn't have been there in the first place, and everybody thinks otherwise is a fool.
Well, it may have been actually more peaceful if the British hadn't turned up and Mountbatten hadn't done this deliberate kind
of... Well, the way the British withdrew obviously created a massive problem, and also the British were in favour of partition. They're the ones who pushed the idea that we probably need two separate states for Hindus and Muslims, because that was a way to divide the opposition to British rule.
So would a two-state solution work in the Middle East as well?
Well, I mean, a two-state solution only works if both sides are willing to make it work. If they're not, then it won't
work.
Well,
I suppose you're right. It's always political expediency. Anyway, finally, before the break, let's have a listen to what's been going on in India. We have obviously similar protests now being cooked up here in the UK. Like those ones that have been going on in the continent.
We're in the car and we're on our way to the border between Punjab and Haryana, and that's where a lot of the clashes are taking place. We're still several kilometers away, and already you see lines and lines of tractors parked on the highway. On the back of the tractors, people have put on plastic tarps, and people are sleeping inside there. In fact, I see people that have pulled out a clothesline and are hanging their clothes to dry. Now remember, all of these tractors were making their way towards Delhi, and they were stopped here, and we're still at least another 250 kilometers away from the capital. I'm out of the car, and I'm still a few hundred meters away from the state line border, and that's where they're being stopped. Around me are hundreds and hundreds of people. I was just offered some tea and biscuits, offered free to everyone. Some men I see are sitting in their cars. One man is peeling an orange. Another group of men are eating parathas and chickpeas and potatoes, very traditional Punjabi dish. It's a real calm, almost jovial atmosphere happening here. Where I'm standing is about 3.5 kilometers away from where we first started seeing tractors assembling. That just gives you a sense of the scale here. There are thousands and thousands of people here.
If they accept our demands, we'll immediately leave this place. Otherwise, we're heading to Delhi and we'll only stop in Delhi. Our children left the country because of unemployment. Previously, there were jobs and even basic education. Now we're paying more for their education and there are no jobs.
What's amazing to me is just how communal everything is here. People are standing around and eating together.
We will protest. We will fight. Our religious leaders have made so many sacrifices. We will do the same. What can any government do to us? All they can do is kill us. We are ready to die.
I'm right up now against the border. This is where people are being prevented from crossing over into Haryana. In front of me is about 100 meters of no man's land, and then you see barbed wire, then concrete barriers. Behind those concrete barriers are all of the paramilitary and police forces. The smell in the air, it's that acidic scent. It's the telltale sign of tear gas.
This time the government has just crossed all limit. They fired every kind of ordnance, tear gas, rubber bullets and other weapons on peaceful protesters. The authorities were very violent this time. Instead of accepting people's demand, giving them justice, they were tear gassed. Such painful act of violence are being done on Prime Minister Modi's orders.
People walk towards the border. They make noise. They're on the receiving end of tear gas. And then they come back, they recover, and then they walk back again.
We can break these barricades in just 2 hours. But our union leaders have stopped us as there are talks going on with the government.
Mm-hmm. So that's a BBC report there from Punjab, Delhi. The latest on this particular protest, there's a massive convoy attempting to make its way to New Delhi, the Indian capital. And we hear Wednesday this week, Indian farmers have now resumed their Delhi protest push after the talk with her. Of course, the government said, oh, talk to us and stop coming towards Delhi and we'll put a police roadblock and then we can have talks. But then, of course, the talks got nowhere. So, Martin, they've gone round the police now and they're still heading trundling with their tractors and everything else back towards Delhi. I think it was in 2020 there was another massive protest, wasn't there? The whole of Delhi was blockaded because farmers can't make a living.
Yeah, it's to do with the what they're trying to do is change the traditional way in which farming has been subsidised by the Indian government. So they used to have marketing boards, so you got a guaranteed price for your stuff. All over the developing world, that's what used to be the standard practice. But of course, since Thatcher and Reagan and all the rest of it, we've got to get rid of marketing boards because they're interfering with the free market. And so what we've got to do is just allow cheaper stuff in from somewhere else. And if your farm goes bust, it goes bust. You'll have to go and be a factory worker or, you know, just live in a slum in Delhi. But of course, the Indian farmers are well organized and they're resisting this process. And for more power to their elbow. Indian farmers are, in fact, quite an important part of the world system because it's because of opposition of India to liberalisation of agriculture, which have affected its farming community, which scuppered various world trade deals, which the World Economic Forum trying to push through various trade deals, you remember at Seattle and Doha, you know, and all the rest of it, they've all run up against the intransigence of the Indian farming community. And there are millions and millions of them. You know, we're not talking about a tiny minority of the existing community as it would be in Britain. These people are numerous. And of course, Modi fighting with them is actually quite difficult for him because he wants to be seen to be a man of the people. But nevertheless, these farmers are not taking very kindly to the direction of travel of his policy. But that's because he's in the pocket of Western oligarchs, I'm afraid.
What about the protests here? They've been starting over the last few weeks. We've now seen, I think this is amazing, to watch the ULEZ protests in London. One of them in Biggin Hill, a tractor turned up, one of the local farmers. And this is to do really with, I suppose, these pseudo-green policies that's what the farmers see, is that you make out that you're trying to do this to make us more green. Actually, this is about freeing up farmland for private equity to buy up. That's what the way the farmers see it. And then I saw another ULEZ protest in London, more centrally in London, not out on the outskirts of Biggin Hill. And there were about five or six of the farmers seemed to be joining up with these. I don't think it's Piers Corbyn particularly, but the anti-ULEZ people. There's an agenda here, Martin. They're saying, actually, look, these green taxes are being imposed fraudulently. They're actually nothing to do with the environment. They're just to do with shutting down the food supply, shutting down people's right to travel, and the agenda you're really working to is World Economic Forum, private equity firms taking over everything.
Well, I think the other thing that's driving these protests across Europe, in Poland, it's because they're being there's lots of Ukrainian grain being dumped into the other East European countries. And don't forget, the massive increase in energy prices makes most farming unviable. It's inevitable that you've got to do something. I mean, obviously, consumers have been subsidised to take the shot, farmers not so much. And there is going to be a huge upheaval. And don't forget, in Holland and in Germany, where these protests have been protesting, we're saying, you're cutting subsidies to our farming. Now, in actual fact, if you had a free market in farming, Tony, a lot of farming in the West wouldn't exist at all. And that was always the policy of the British government, even in the 19th century, was to get people off the land, get them into the factories and get all the food in from Canada,
one of the other things
Argentina
and
Australia.
Modern farming requires lots and lots of investment, nice shiny new tractors and all sorts of big, hefty, expensive farm equipment. One of the major problems for farmers here has been the upping of interest rates. This is suddenly
Well, of course, but you've got to up the interest rates to bring down down the inflation, which has been caused
interest rate always brings down inflation.
Well, it does, but it does bring down inflation by causing a crash.
And
everybody goes out of business.
By forcing everyone to put their prices up. That doesn't sound like bringing down inflation.
You cannot. I mean, Erdogan in Turkey.
This was all started by Sunak, by the way, jacking up fuel prices a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but the jacking up of
and
fuel prices is because the Americans
tax.
Have blown up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
Another green tax. Not oil.
Yes, I know, but the point is all of this forces the price of substitutes up. Yeah?
So anyway, they're playing with us. They're playing around with us, and so no wonder the farmers are getting angry. If we don't have any farms, we won't have any food. That's their slogan. No farmers, no food.
She posts another letter to the side. in the pocket of her raincoat. Oh, it's just another day.
Okay, and if you want to join in on the other bits, it's an evolution, you know, say what you like, and it's on the wall, and it doesn't, those bits aren't important, you know, that's just a fill-in. Yeah. Okay?
One, two, one, two, three, four!
John Lennon and Paul McCartney there, actually, 1969, was Give Peace a Chance, and 1971 was what I like to think is, in a way, it's like Paul McCartney's version of Morning's Broken. It's a bit silly, but Another Day, that's cool, from 1971. I'm not sure if it's actually Wings, maybe before Paul started Wings, but anyway. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And as you just heard, the choir of Salisbury Cathedral beginning our break there. But Martin, after the break, we're looking at two people, Julian Assange and Donald Trump. I'm not quite sure how linked the pair of them are, but I think we should look at Julian first. The hearing this week apparently is the last one, as we heard from John Shipton, Julian's dad, last week, before it all goes to the European Court of Human Rights. And I mean, this is now 15 years of torture, 15 years of extrajudicial bullying. Torture, most definitely, of an innocent man. And so what do you make, what's just before we hear from Max Blumenthal, who's going to be our first speaker from the Strand on Tuesday, what do you make of this whole, it's become almost like a cause célèbre, and it's impossible for the West to point their finger at anywhere else on earth while this guy's in jail?
Well, that's right. You'd have thought they'd have cut their losses long before this. But they've got the sunk cost fallacy, haven't they? If we let him go now, we're going to look really stupid. So we've got to keep him in prison.
It's not a fallacy. It's not a fallacy. They're doing this deliberately to send a message to all editors.
That's also true.
Journalists, everybody. Look what happens when you take us on. Look what we can do. Let's have a listen, I suppose. First of all, to Max Blumenthal. He's played an important role as well with the Grey Zone, hasn't he? He's doing all sorts of work in the journalistic world. What do you reckon? What do you make of Max? I mean, people sometimes say to me, can we trust him?
I like his stuff. I mean, of course,
I think he's brilliant. Yeah.
They're a very good website.
We are fighting not only for the right of Julian Assange to hold his children and be with his wife, we're fighting for the right to expose the secret government, the national security state, the Central Intelligence Agency, which has a $90 billion or more black budget, which has infested Facebook, Twitter, and other social media platforms with its former agents. And we see Garland Nixon here is banned from Twitter. I thought Elon Musk was exposing censorship. Yeah. National security state contractor Elon Musk, I thought he was exposing censorship. He said only the right is censored. But why are anti-imperialists like Garland Nixon censored? Why are they suspended? Why? Why isn't he leaking the files about that? Why isn't he leaking the files about Russiagate? Why isn't he leaking the files about everyone who criticized the Ukraine proxy war being suspended? Why has Elon Musk not restored the Twitter account of Julian Assange? Can we at least free Julian Assange's Twitter account? So I want to close by reading an email from Julian Assange. Hi all, I'm in Iceland. You should be too, or at least reporting about it. I've been in Iceland the past few weeks advising parliamentarians here on a cross-party proposal to turn Iceland into an international journalism haven, a jurisdiction designed to attract organizations into publishing online from Iceland by adopting the strongest press and source protection laws from around the world. In my role as WikiLeaks editor, I've been involved in fighting off many legal attacks. To do that and keep our sources safe, we have had to spread assets, encrypt everything, and move telecommunications and people around the world to activate protective laws and national jurisdictions. It goes on, but he says, that's why I'm excited about what is happening in Iceland, which has started to see the world in a new way after its mini revolution a year ago. That was February 2010, and today Julian Assange has been captured. And he was captured because he was, and he's being tortured because he was leading a revolution in journalism. And that's why. Not because he violated some Espionage Act. So it's our job today to continue that revolution, to continue the revolution that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks started, and to see Julian Assange standing here with us and his family.
That's Max Blumenthal there. He did get a massive round of applause, I guarantee, of course. But Martin, the important point he's making, Julian actually is a revolutionary in journalism. What he was doing was he was actually utilising the internet in the most powerful way possible to expose war criminals.
Well, that's right, and that's why they hate him so much. I noticed that the Australian Parliament, in fact, passed a resolution demanding his release, which is very, very welcome. I think, you know, although it's been terrible for him, I think it's an eye-opener for anybody who's got any sense to realise what kind of a state we live in.
None of that was reported on the news at all. But this is one of the things Tony Benn pointed this out in his 2005, I think it was, in his Benn lecture that I helped produce here in Bristol and found when I was the vice chair of... just after I've been, I think I may have been secretary still of the journalist NUJ union branch here, that actually this is an important thing, that the news never reports the actual speeches made. And of course they should do.
Well, they should, but as we know, it's controlled, which is why we have to rely on shows like this and people like Julian Assange if you want to know what's going on.
They'll get some BBC correspondent who was there that will tell you what transpired. But what you won't get is people speaking with their own voices. And this isn't really news. So, I mean, the media, again, is really very much in the spotlight, the mass media, the ownership of it, the control of it, the control of information. And this is a recurring theme quite clearly through the whole Julian Assange case. This is basically criminals covering their tracks. This is why Assange is being persecuted. One of the main speakers was Andrew Feinstein, the author of The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, and also a former ANC MP over in South Africa. And South Africa, of course, has been involved in the International Court of Justice action against the Israelis over the Gaza genocide. So it was interesting to hear his take on what's happening in Gaza. And also, he was one of the main speakers down at the Assange hearing.
This is something that we can all see every day with our own eyes on our screens. It's not something we needed the highest court in the world to tell us. But let us also remember what was included in South Africa's submission. The intentional targeting and killing of Palestinian journalists on the ground. Why are they doing that? Because they do not want us to know what they are doing on the ground to innocent Palestinians. Those journalists are informing the world of what is happening. This is exactly what Julian has spent his life doing. In the 23 years that I've been investigating and researching the murderous and corrupt global trade in weapons, the most effective, the most important truth teller on the global arms trade, on the warfare committed in our names with our tax pounds, has been Julian Assange. And while those who committed the war crimes have not only all gone free, but have all profiteered from their war crimes, it is Julian who speaks truth to power who is on trial. But it is not only Julian who is on trial. It is the British system of justice. It is the British government. It is the US government. It is our entire system of war-making, of imperialism, and of deep-seated corruption. Forgive me for paraphrasing my former boss, Nelson Mandela, but the reality of our democracies, of our world, is that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of Julian Assange. Yes.
So that's the author of Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade, Andrew Feinstein, speaking earlier this week in the Strand outside the High Court. Another one of these farcical hearings where some judge with some connections to MI6 or the security services or the British military is just basically sitting there nodding away doing the job of the Americans, Martin.
Well, that's right. Andrew Feinstein is an excellent person, a very strong, principled guy. I understand that I'm not sure whether he was taught thinking about it. I don't know whether he's going to go ahead with it. He's going to stand against Starmer in his North London constituency at the next election.
I think he is. Yeah. So the idea really is to try and strip away any kind of potential support that. You know, the left might have for the Labour Party, and maybe possibly even get Starmer not to be re-elected, which would be fascinating. So these are all good tactics, but what do you make of this slow torture of Assange? I mean, the fact that we heard, I don't know if people listened to the whole interview I did with John Shipton last week, but he finished off and I asked him, I said, well, Stella has said that if Julian is sent to the United States, he'll die.
Well, he didn't.
John said that he couldn't contemplate that, but this is likely, it's going to end up a bit like Navalny, isn't it?
Well, except it's not clear that Navalny was killed by the state, even though he was in their prison. But Julian Assange didn't turn up to his own hearing because he's too ill. I think that tells you everything you need to know.
It certainly does. So that interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But then there was also, after the various WikiLeaks speeches, there was this place called the Frontline Club in London, which is a brilliant little institution where people like John Pilger over the years have spoken, many journalists, particularly on foreign affairs, have spoken. And just to sort of underline Max Blumenthal's speech, he's got a guy, Kit Clarenberg, who seems to do most of the stories here in the UK, and they're flagging up this thing which we'd hear very, very little about, something called the National Security Act in the UK.
Yeah.
Kit Clarenberg is saying that the UK is stepping up war on whistleblower journalism. So the idea is if you're blowing the whistle on the fascist state, then you could end up in jail yourself. This is all very much creeping fascism going here on here in Britain with these acts, including the act a few years ago. Do you remember the one about we can kill you if we're from a government agency like the Environment Agency and you can't prosecutors. I mean, these sorts of things are enabling acts for a kind of fascist regime in Britain here. Under a repressive new act, British nationals could face prison for undermining London's national security line. Intended to destroy WikiLeaks and others exposing war crimes, the law is a direct threat to critical national security journalism. So as people, I suppose, who are war criminals within the government and the British military are seeing that, oh dear, you know, someone might find us out. So what they're doing is they're trying to bring in legislation to stop anyone exposing them. It was the afternoon of May the 17th, 2023, and says Kit Clarenberg, and he just arrived at London's Luton Airport. He was on the way to the city to visit his family. Before landing, the pilot instructed all passengers to have their passports ready for inspection immediately on disembarking the plane. Just then, I noticed a six-strong squad of stony-faced, plainclothes British counter-terror officers. This is this rather nasty lot of the Met, little side branch of the Met Police, who seem to be like a kind of Gestapo, basically, these days. British counter-terror officers waited on the tarmac, intensely studying the identification documents of all travellers. As soon as the cops identified me, I was ordered to accompany them into the airport terminal with no explanation. I was introduced to two officers whose names I could not learn, who subsequently referred to each other using nondescript call signs. I was invited to be digitally strip searched and subject to an interrogation in which I had no right to silence, no right to refuse to answer questions, and no right to withhold PIN numbers from my digital devices or SIM cards. If I asserted any rights to privacy, I faced arrest and 48 hours in police custody. And over the next 5 hours, I sat with a couple of anonymous counter-terror cops in an airless, windowless, excruciatingly hot back room, fingerprinted me, took invasive DNA swabs and probed every conceivable aspect of my private and professional life, friend and family connections, and educational background. They wanted to know why I write, say and think the things I do. So this is, I'll put a link up to this article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. What he's saying is this new act is going to actually make this much more normal, much more formal, and it turns out the British state believed the Grey Zone had a relationship with Russia's FSB security service, Martin.
Well, yeah, that's what they claim. And of course, there's been talk this week that they're going to ban protests and demonstrations outside the Houses of Parliament and outside city councils because it's dangerous. And we've got to move on, and the whole Lindsay Hoyle affair was based around the idea that MPs are under threat and are potentially going to be murdered by protesters. Now, I understand that there's got to be concern about people involved in politics being murdered, like Olaf Palme was in Sweden all those years ago, probably by NATO. But you can't have a situation where elected representatives are not prepared to confront people who disagree with them.
Do you know what Kit Kahrenberg is? He's a thought criminal.
Well, indeed he is.
Julian Assange, a thought criminal.
That's right. Thought crime.
And actually, you, Martin Summers, me, Tony Gosling, hold your hands up, man. We're thought criminals.
We are indeed, Tony, and proud of it.
And we just keep doing this day after day. But the thing is, there are certain things that our fascist, and I use this word increasingly, because really, really, Martin, doesn't it, surely all it really means is that big corporations, big pharma, the arms industry, are calling the shots, and people like Rishi Sunak are just bending over for them.
Yes, I mean, the use of the word fascism has been rather degraded over the years, because anybody you don't like, you just call them a fascist. But I think the idea that the Western deep state, controlled by the big banks and the military, isn't fascist. I mean, it's increasingly becoming clear that it is. And we're directly supporting fascists in the Ukraine. For example, the British Army have trained the Azov Battalion, who, interestingly enough, were decimated this week in Avdiivka. They were just smashed. They were sent in to save the situation, and they all ended up dead. And I'm sure lots of people will be weeping over that.
Yeah, I did say last week, in error, that the Russians had left a road out of Avdiivka in order so that people could escape. But actually, no, they were killing them as they were trying to get out of Avdiivka too. I suppose they would have to actually just surrender to the Russian frontline troops if they wanted to live.
That's right. There were quite a lot of surrenders, but it's very difficult for the Ukrainians to surrender because, of course, the Russians aren't going in. The Russians are trying to keep their own people alive, so they're not going they're not going,
incidentally, it just reminded me, I was listening to talk radio for my sins, Julia Hartley Burr, I think, yesterday. Matthew Paris was on, saying that it's the age of 27 or 26, anyone over that age is being conscripted in Ukraine, and they're now talking about bringing the age down below that. So young people he spoke to when he was over there recently are absolutely really, really afraid. They don't want to be involved in the fight with Russia, and they're considering ways of getting out the country so that they don't get conscripted to die fighting Russia.
Well, you'd have thought that the people they would go to conscript would be the youngsters, but in actual fact, up to now, people are doing studies of any kind, no doubt the children of the elite.
But it's older than that. It's up to sort of 26 or so years old, and these are the youngsters that are very worried. And apparently, a lot of this sacking of this Ukrainian defense leader was to do with there is a pushback against the idea of recruiting these sort of early mid 20 year old men to fight Russia, because they just think that, well, there's no point, we're going to die, there's absolutely no point in this.
Well, you're right, but of course the British military are saying, I think it was Grant Shapps saying it's about time that they conscripted the young. We've killed off the middle-aged, let's kill the young now. And of course, quite a lot of young people have already been killed in one way or another. But it's isn't it interesting how the massive military casualties in Ukraine compared to the civilian casualties? There have been civilian casualties on both sides. They're using British missiles to fire at Belgrade, which landed on a shopping centre. That was our missile, people. We paid for that. But in actual fact, that both sides, the level of civilian casualties has been fractional compared to what's happening in Gaza.
Interesting. It's illustrative of just completely different ways of waging war, isn't it? Gaza and Ukraine. Amazing. Anyway, let's have a listen now over to the States. A new emperor is being formed as we speak of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, and his name is Donald Trump. I find it absolutely fascinating to see this, the way that the court cases against Trump seem to be making him stronger, Martin. Let's have a listen now to his speech in Waterford, in Michigan, just after this latest court case.
But we want to win November 5th. November 5th, we're going to get this guy out. We're going to change our country. We're going to bring our country back. Bring our country back from hell. So don't wait. Get out and vote. When we win back the White House, we will have no higher priority than ending the weaponization of this horrible legal system that is developed around us. It's a horrible, horrible thing that's taking place. You talk about democracy. This is a real threat to democracy and restoring fair, equal, and impartial justice in America. We have to have that, because we don't have that now. The decision yesterday in New York, you may have read about it. Crooked judge. He's a crooked judge. By a radical left-wing judge, was a lawless and unconstitutional atrocity that sets fire to our laws like no one has ever seen in this country before. That happens in banana republics. It doesn't happen in this country. The case is a complete and total sham. It's a sham case. There were no victims, no defaults, no damages, no complaints, no nothing. There was nothing. The actual bankers who were involved in the loan transactions that were talked about testified at the trial. They said that Donald Trump was a highly sought after whale. They called me a whale. I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know if they meant a whale from the standpoint of being a little heavy or a whale because I got a lot of money. But I think they meant the second. But he's a whale of a client. We love him. He's a whale of a client, one of the strongest personal balance sheets that they've ever seen. And he was actually very overqualified for the loan. I didn't even need this loan. Those banks earned more than $100 million in profits doing business with me and my companies. They were very happy, and they testified that way. The expert witness, one of the most respected anywhere in the country, anywhere in the United States, said that my financial statements were the best that he's ever seen. That's not bad. The best that he's ever seen. This was a case of satisfied banks and insurance companies, which made a lot of money dealing with me, and a lot of very happy money and good money. Great financial statements, the best, really great financial statements that didn't even include the most valuable asset, the Trump brand. Ironclad disclaimer. Do you know what a disclaimer is? We have an ironclad disclaimer. That's like buyer beware. It means do your own due diligence. Don't believe what you're reading. It's all good, but don't even believe it. Go out and do your own due diligence. You have to go. You have to do that. We had an unbelievable disclaimer, and the amazing properties, some of the best all over the world, and highly underleveraged. We're very underleveraged as a company. I had very little debt, a lot of cash, because we built a great company. And, you know, unlike these other politicians, I knew it would happen. I didn't think it would be this much, but I knew I would lose $1 billion or $2 billion if I was honest running for president and being president. And that's what I lost, maybe a couple of billion dollars. And it was the best thing I ever did, because we've made our country, we made it great. They've blown it, but we're going to make it greater than ever before. We're going to make it greater than ever before. But these other guys, they go in, they have no money. All of a sudden, they're rich. Look at Nancy Pelosi. She's worth like $150 million. The judge, one of the least respected in New York State, said that Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. Now, you don't really know too much about it, but it's very valuable real estate, let me put it that way. Was worth $18 million in order to try to make his case. By doing that, he brought the values way down. He tried to make his case, when in actuality, it's worth anywhere from 50 to 100 times that amount. And the appraisers say that. That's not me saying it. The biggest broker in Florida said it. Wait till you hear about the unconstitutional gag order. That's going to be great. The justice, this judge, he gagged. He doesn't want me to talk. You're not allowed to talk. Because when you hear me talk, you'll say, oh, wow, this is a corrupt system. The case was brought under a consumer fraud statute that has never, ever been used before for this purpose. In fact, a very unfriendly media company, they hate me, said that they studied litigation going back many, many years, and no case, not one case was ever brought like this in the history of New York State. This is the only one. I wonder if they were doing that for political purposes or for election interference. This is merely an election interference ploy by a crazed lunatic attorney general. Did you ever see this attorney general? She's a lunatic working closely with a very bad judge. No jury was allowed. I wasn't allowed a jury.
Okay, let's leave it there. Donald Trump going on for a rather longer than Joe Biden manages to. But last week, Bobby Kennedy, that's Robert Kennedy Jr., the nephew of JFK, and son of Bobby Kennedy, JFK's brother, who were both assassinated in the US, he announced that Donald Trump had quietly approached him, Martin, to say, would you like to be my vice presidential candidate?
Well, if he says it, I trust what RFK says. And if he says that Trump has approached him to be the vice presidential candidate, I believe it.
He said no, because he wants to stand on his own.
That's right, because he's going to be an independent. He and Trump have got some things that they share, but at the end of the day, Bobby Kennedy is a Democrat from a Democrat family.
That would be an interesting ticket, wouldn't it? Would it be interesting? Well, I mean, to have a Republican president and a Democrat vice president, I don't know if they've ever done that before.
Well, I mean, if the system in the US was similar to the system in Russia, where they've got a presidential election coming up, they could all stand in the first round and see how many votes everybody got, and then they could bargain in the second round, which is what happens in France. But of course, in the US, it's a winner take all, and if more than two big candidates are standing, the third big candidate actually can mess it up so that whoever wins doesn't get a majority of the votes.
You mean a whale?
Well, I mean, that's a whale is a financial term. But I mean, this is what it could easily happen here. RFK will take enough votes off Biden to prevent Biden from winning, which allows Trump to win with less than 50% of the vote and get total power. Yeah. Except he won't have total power because the military will not do what he says because they've got their own ideas.
In a way, it might be a good idea for Bobby Kennedy to change his mind about that. Who knows? Anything can happen in the United States. Who knows? And people can get bumped off too down the road. But I mean, what bothers me is we've almost got a kind of pre-World War II situation being created in the United States with, I mean, you remember the beer hall putsch, which Adolf Hitler was arrested for and jailed. It's almost as if Donald Trump is being set up as the victim, just as Hitler was.
Well, I think the left wing, if you can call them that, the sort of liberals, because they're not really left wing, the liberals in the United States see that their rhetoric is that Trump is Hitler. Well, I think that's overdone. Trump is Trump. He's bad enough as he is.
Yeah, but can you just take what I just said on board? The idea is to deliberately set up a leader as a victim, and then in order to garner public sympathy, and that sort of person. Trump, I would imagine, is very easy to press his buttons. If they wanted to start a world war, it'd be quite easy to do. Press a few Trump buttons, and Trump will do exactly what he's expected to do.
He will, and the idea that he will stand up to the... I mean, what happened is he said, I want to keep US troops in Syria so that we can steal the oil. He came straight out with it, which, of course, everybody winced. You're not supposed to say it. And he said, apart from that, we need to withdraw. But, of course, the military subsequently boasted that they had frustrated Trump and they'd refused
anyway,
to withdraw.
Let's crack through this, Martin, because he did also in this speech talk quite a bit about his foreign policy, starting off with Mexico.
I went to Mexico, and you know this, and I got along really great, but I went to them. I told them, look, fellas, you got to give us 28,000 soldiers. They looked at me like, what a stupid request. What the hell would... They're going like, why would we give him 28,000? You know, they're laughing. They think we're all a bunch of dummies, right? I said, no, no, you have to, because they've taken advantage of it, including taking 32%. By the way, 32% of what you had here is right now being done in Mexico. That's over the last 20 years, 32%. And they'll take the rest of it, too. And remember the story about the plan. But think of this. So I said, no, you have to give us 28,000 soldiers because we're building the wall and we need protection. And you're allowing people to walk through on the caravans. Thousands and thousands of people coming from all over the world. Yesterday, they had many from the Congo. Welcome to the Congo, people, because, and where do you come in the Congo? Where do you live? We were in prison. What for? Murder. Oh, great. So they're being put, and who can blame? They're coming from Africa. They're coming from Asia. They're coming from different parts of the Middle East. They're coming from Yemen. We're bombing Yemen. You know, here's this idiot is again bombing. When I came in, they were bombing. I got it stopped. You don't have to bomb. Every bomb is $1 million. You know that. 1 million. Every time you see a little flash, it's 1 million. But more importantly, you're killing a lot of people. You don't have to kill the people. We don't want to kill people. We want a solution to things. You would have never had Ukraine and Russia. You would have never had Israel. Israel would have never been attacked. Ukraine would have never been attacked. Putin would have never attacked. In fact, Putin said the other day, no, I prefer Biden as president. I said, I don't know why. I stopped Nord Stream 2. It was totally stopped. I stopped Nord Stream 2. Biden came in, he approved it. But he stopped the Keystone. So he let Russia build their pipeline to Germany and other places. But he stopped the Keystone, 48,000 jobs. And the head, remember this for the auto workers, the head of the pipeline union endorsed Sleepy Joe Biden, endorsed him. Now, he should be out of a job. And all those guys, now almost every worker voted for me because they're smart, you know. But you have the same thing in the auto workers. Most of the auto workers are going to vote for me. I'm going to bring jobs back. You're going to lose all your jobs. And we're waiting for the Teamsters. And I will tell you, the biggest threat to your unions is millions of people coming across the border. Because you're not going to have your jobs anymore. Even that good-looking, strong guy with those beautiful muscles, he's not going to have his job. Because they'll have somebody else take it for one-third the price and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You're not going to, right? You not. Look, he's agreeing. Don't laugh. He's laughing. Don't laugh. I mean, you know, we got to be serious here. The truth is, though, when you have millions of people coming in, they're going to take your jobs. They're going to take the Teamster jobs. You know, we're waiting because the Teamsters haven't endorsed a Republican in many, many years. And they're having a hard time with this. How do they endorse a man who's a low IQ individual? How do they do it? That's Sleepy Joe. How do they endorse or Crooked Joe? Which is a better name, Crooked Joe Biden or Sleepy Joe Biden?
So, yeah, what do you think that the crowd said? Crooked Joe or Sleepy Joe? Which do they prefer?
Are we going to find out?
He did a little vote in it, so right. I'm just asking you, Martin, what if you were a Trump?
Well, they presumably voted for Crooked Joe.
They certainly did. They cheered about three times louder Crooked Joe than Sleepy Joe.
Yeah.
But on his foreign policy, he doesn't really... I mean, he's basically saying, I will threaten Putin, you know, more. So, he's saying, I'll end the war in Ukraine, but I'm going to really push Putin
around.
It
wouldn't have started if I was in charge, because Putin would have been scared of me, which is laughable. Absolutely laughable.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that to a certain extent, you can see that, you know, a lot of Americans looking at Trump saying, well, he actually didn't really start the wars, did he? He
was, well, that's rubbish.
He was involved in creating the situation where they pulled out of Afghanistan under Biden a year or so after Trump was there. He wanted to pull troops out of Afghanistan. He kept talking about it anyway. So, you know, you do wonder whether this is all... I mean, I really am completely conflicted over Trump, the way that he's... It seems as if he's being set up as a, you know, very loud, powerful war president, actually.
I think you're right. If he wins, and it looks like he will, because as you say, all of these...
Because he's got this track record of no war, but...
I'm going to dispute that, Tony. When you say no war, he continued the wars that were started by Bush, continued by Obama.
No new wars, anyway.
No, he assassinated General Soleimani and various leaders of the Iraqi PMC militias.
Well, those were certainly acts of war,
and what could have happened there, the Iranians could have said, right, we're going to start whacking back. And they didn't. What they did is they attacked one base. They gave them warnings so they could all get into the air raid shelters, and then they showed them what they could do.
Is he really going to make any difference in the Middle East? That's very unlikely.
Well, no, because what Trump basically moved the capital,
the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv
to Jerusalem. Totally unilaterally. Yeah.
Exactly,
he recognised the annexation of the Golan Heights.
Wanted.
Yes, and in actual fact, he is 100% and RFK, and this is what's shocking. They're all 100% behind the Israeli genocide.
Yeah.
So nobody in the rest of the world has got anybody to vote for at all. We're all at war with the United States of America. And that country simply has to lose, like Nazi Germany and Japan lost in World War II.
Is actually the Americans are... have a $14 billion US aid package for Israel ready to prepare for a multi-front war, not just Gaza. The $17 billion, antiwar.com say, is included in the $95 billion foreign military aid budget passed by the Senate. Additional military aid for Israel Biden is seeking was designed not just for operations in Gaza, to prepare Israel for a multi-front war, the Times of Israel reports.
Well, it's interesting to me, because if Biden was a different kind of Democrat president, he could win the election by saying, I'm going to pull the plug on Israel. Vote for me, because I'm not going to... All the money that they talk about wasting, US taxpayers waste a hell of a lot of money on Israel.
Zelensky tried that, didn't he? I'm going to stop the war, vote for me.
Yes, and of course Biden isn't going to do that, because he supports the Israelis to the hilt, as do all US politicians. With Bernie Sanders is an honourable exception to a point. He occasionally clears his throat and says, this is all going a bit far, isn't it? And of course, he is of Jewish extraction, as are many decent people.
The Chinese are also lining up, I noticed, today. China has told the International Court of Justice that the Palestinians have the right to use armed force against Israel. Beijing tells a historic hearing that armed struggle against occupation is a legitimate and well-founded right. So that's China, that's yesterday actually, backing the right of the Palestinian people to armed force to combat Israel's occupation of their land, calling it an inalienable right and well-founded in international law. This is the Chinese lining up behind the Palestinians.
Well, they generally tend, the Chinese in the past, to try and not be too provocative in the things they say. So when they're saying that, it really does start to make, you know, because of course they know that they're probably going to have to go to war with the United States, because the United States keeps telling them that's what they're going to do. So the Chinese are beginning to lose their inhibitions about saying what they really think. And of course it is the case that the Palestinians do have a right to armed resistance in international law, because they just do. And of course, some of the tactics they adopted on October the 7th are questionable, but the right to resist is absolutely unquestionable. And don't forget, many of the so-called hostages being held in Gaza, many of whom have been killed by the Israelis, bombing indiscriminately, are actually military personnel. They are military personnel and therefore prisoners of war. They are not hostages, they're POWs. And they can be exchanged for other POWs, just like they are in Ukraine, and so on.
Okay,
Martin,
we're going to look now at a documentary. I think it's a couple of years old, but I'd never come across it before. It's actually made in Moscow. It's called Russia and England, Loveless Deceit. Before we hear a clip from that, the Russians do see the Brits as very difficult players over the centuries. And this is largely about the First World War and the British role in the Russian Revolution, the overthrowing of the Romanovs and the betrayal, as they see it, during World War I. So what do you know about that?
Well, they see us as Britain and Russia have seen themselves as potential adversaries going back to the 19th century. Don't forget, we invaded Crimea. Remember? It wasn't the Russians who invaded Dorset. We invaded Crimea, which was very definitely part of Russia then, as it is now. But we invaded them, remember? And it was all to do with the fact that we felt that the Russians wanted to take India off us. Yeah? That was a big deal. The great game, Peter Hopkirk.
Okay, so I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the full interview, which is a Russian documentary made for Russians, but voiced into English all the way through. So it's actually fairly easy to watch and listen to. Russia and England's Loveless Deceit.
In January 1917, an Allied military conference was held in Petrograd. Its official agenda included final settlement of the territorial changes after victory. However, the British delegation had a different mission at the conference, affecting a change of government in Russia. Lord Milner, who had earlier presented Nicholas II with an ultimatum, was in charge of the conspiracy to overthrow the legitimate Russian government. We now know who Milner was counting on to carry out his plans. The Russian Duma opposition, including head of the Zemsky Union, Prince Georgi Lvov, chairman of the State Duma of the Third Convocation, Alexander Kuchkov. Leader of the Constitutional Democratic Party, Pavel Milyukov, and chairman of the State Duma of the Fourth Convocation, Mikhail Radzianka. As planned by the British, these opposition figures were to become a tool for overthrowing the Russian government with the use of their supporters. What did the plan entail? It was quite cynical. During the meeting, Lord Milner skillfully exploited the vices and insecurities of the liberal opposition. He promised power and distinction to the vainest of them, untold riches to the greedy, with everyone finally being accepted into the family of enlightened Europeans, not as representatives of barbaric Russia, but as heroic fighters for the ideals of freedom. All the opposition had to do to get there was betray their motherland, and what's more, push Nicholas II to bow to London. Or should the emperor uphold Russia's interests, Britain would help the Russian opposition overthrow him. The British emissary vowed that London would spare no expense to hasten the revolutionary conflagration. Perhaps this was the only promise that he kept with the Russian traitors, because Prime Minister of Great Britain Lord George, who sent him to Russia, had been head of the Treasury until recently. Now, as Prime Minister, he still held the finances of the Empire in his hands. And knowing how much he hated Russia, one could safely assume that, if necessary, he would cut the budgets for public health and education, as long as he could overthrow Nicholas II, who was proving such a nuisance to Great Britain.
Specifically, it was General Janin who claimed that Britain had allocated £20 million to fund the revolution in Russia. He said, for example, that a soldier was paid 25 rubles for not leaving the barracks or quitting military units. That was indeed a lot of money. And, of course, their financial involvement was very strong. Remember, they were also lining the pockets of a variety of opposition leaders. Britain invested large amounts of money to destabilize the situation and to set the stage for the February coup.
If it were not for this conspiracy involving pseudo-democratic detractors of the monarchy in the British Parliament, which itself directly sponsored the coup, then after the Russian army's convincing victories in the 1916 military campaign, Nicholas II would have remained in power. And perhaps Russia's history would have taken a different turn. It is impossible to know. The British themselves, or rather the most respected Englishman of the 20th century, Winston Churchill, said so. In his book, The World Crisis, 1916 to 1918, he wrote about the last Russian emperor, Nicholas II. The Tsar was on the throne. The Russian Empire and the Russian army held out. The front was secured and victory is indisputable. In spite of errors, vast and terrible, the regime he personified, over which he presided, to which his personal character gave the vital spark, had, at this moment, won the war for Russia. This is corroborated by Prime Minister of Great Britain David Lloyd George. As we know from eyewitness accounts, having learned the news of Nicholas II's abdication from the throne, the British Prime Minister smugly said for everyone to hear, "One of the main goals that England set in this war has been achieved."
That's a clip from this documentary, Russia, England, Loveless to See. A fascinating look at the Russian version of this, Martin. In a way, you know, for you lefties, this is a bit of a, you know, disappointment, isn't it? I thought most lefties rather like the idea of the Russian workers overthrowing the government all on their own. It looks as if maybe there was a few million pounds of British money helping it.
Well, what they're talking about there is the February Revolution, which brought Kerensky to power.
Let's just be clear, because there were two,
There was one in February and one in October.
Right.
So there's the February Revolution and the October Revolution. And, of course, the October Revolution, it was the German general staff that took Lenin from Zurich to the Finland station to overthrow Kerensky. But, of course, the British were probably involved in the overthrow of Nicholas II, because what they wanted was a Lloyd George, for example, was very hostile to the Russian monarchy. He always had been. And the British historically were hostile to the Russians because they saw them as a threat to the British Empire.
But they'd been allied with them. They were allied with them in both world wars.
Well, indeed. But of course, don't forget the British see themselves as the senior, as just as the Americans do today. They see themselves as the senior partners in any relationship in which they're involved.
Isn't it fascinating to see Lord Milner involved as well? This guy who is behind the round table groups, that is, set up the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute for International Affairs. So every time you see some guest from Chatham House on the TV talking nonsense about foreign policy, which is just basically a kind of Anglo-Zionist Empire arms industry point of view. That was him that started that as well.
Well, interestingly enough, if you read Adam Tooze's, he's a historian writing about this period, he points out that once Kerensky came to power in Russia, the Russians had an ostensibly democratic system. The Americans, Woodrow Wilson, got elected in the US on a not going to war platform, just as Roosevelt was elected on a similar platform. But he coined the phrase peace without victory. And the first thing that Woodrow Wilson tried to do was talk to the British and the French, talk to the Germans, talk to the Russians with their newly democratic government. Maybe we can just freeze the front lines and settle all this without outright victory for anybody. And that actually would have been a good result.
Well, that sounds a bit like Ukraine.
Well, then we could fix them, but we don't want to fix them, do we?
There's actually more evidence coming up this week, and I'll share this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of Alexei Navalny, first of all, calling Muslims in the Caucasus cockroaches, and secondly, leading a neo-Nazi rally with a whole bunch of Nazis doing Nazi salutes in Moscow. So no, it's not hardly surprising that Putin arrested him when he came to Russia.
Well, no, but in theory, what Navalny's been sent down for is two things, but you know, I've been reading about this
I will share these if people are a little bit skeptical about Navalny. Then
there's a very good article by
Neo-Nazi
Scott Ritter about Navalny. It's a two-part article. I've read the first part. The second part is coming out about the whole history of Navalny and where he's coming from and what he's about. And of course, he's not about anything now because he's dead.
Yes, well, he is about something because he's being used constantly all the time. And in fact, his mother and his wife have now been sort of weaponized by NATO at the Munich Security Conference.
What was very interesting, Stephen Karanovic, who's Serbian, pointed out that Navalny's death was reported on the Russian prison service website, which is a very obscure website. You can imagine most people don't have it popping into their feed. But 15 minutes later, all of these weighty Western politicians weighed in to say, isn't it terrible about Navalny? Which implies that they knew he was going to die.
Yes, it does. And it's pretty sure that they did. So how did they kill him, do you think? Is it possible? How did the West bump him off?
Because the British intelligence services in particular have got a whole infrastructure inside Russia. The FSB are very well aware of this. Okay? So they're not necessarily British nationals.
Some weapon from a drone, a parasite. These so-called scalar weapons, Martin, cause heart attacks from a distance.
Yes, there's all sorts of possibilities. Just imagine, it is not in Putin's interest for Navalny to die just at this moment before the Munich Security Conference.
The first day of the Munich Security Conference.
And as luck would have it, Yulia Navalny was already invited to speak. So it's a perfect platform for her. Yeah. And don't forget Boris Nemtsov, who was shot
on outside the Kremlin, the police
on the bridge.
Yeah, the police in Moscow investigated all of that thoroughly, and they caught the people who shot him. They caught the people who gave the orders. They chased it all the way back to the Caucasus, and then they couldn't find out who'd actually given the orders. And of course, it probably was the British intelligence service who killed the men.
And he had Nemtsov,
as they killed Berezovsky in Surrey.
Yeah,
and people.
About Nemtsov, because I remember being asked by RT to report it at the time, and just with a 15 or 20 minutes to do some quick research beforehand, I dug up what I thought was a fascinating fact, which was that Nemtsov had actually called out some of the other Russian opposition leaders and parties, even though of course they're minnows compared to the Russian Communist Party, for taking money from the West, and at which point he was then killed. The idea is you don't point this out, that these people are actually taking money from the West, and if you do, this is what's going to happen to you. Anyway, so we just heard that clip from the Russia-England Loveless Deceit, which I think is a really interesting little documentary, may fill in some facts which have been missing for many, many years by the Russians from what really happened in their revolutions and their war with England particularly. But also, what about this whole idea of Martin and I being non-state hostile intelligence service? Is that what we are, Martin?
Well, that's what they say we are, although we're probably not important enough to be called that.
Mike Pompeo referred to WikiLeaks. Let's have a listen now as our final little bit from WikiLeaks. Christian Hrafnsson, who's the now editor of WikiLeaks, the Icelandic guy, he's a quite quietly spoken guy. We had an interview with him about 6 months ago on here. Absolutely brilliant. And one of the things he pointed out was that maybe the prosecution of WikiLeaks and Assange may have had nothing to do with the US war machine, because the Icelandic people were most grateful to WikiLeaks for actually providing the documents that they used to jail the banksters over in Iceland. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Christian Hrafnsson speaking early this week at the Frontline Club after the very public speeches made outside the High Court.
Most embarrassing leak in CIA's history, and the fury was obvious. And you have to remember that at that time, Mike Pompeo was the director of CIA. This is in the early years of 2017. And shortly after, in his first public sort of speaking engagement, he went to the podium and talked about the gravest danger facing the United States of America, which was Al-Qaeda and WikiLeaks, the journalist organization and Al-Qaeda. And it's then when he carefully turned this definition of WikiLeaks, and it was, we didn't realize that at the time. I did not realize how serious this was when he said, this is a WikiLeaks is a non-state hostile intelligence service. Everybody dismissed it as being sort of hot air at the time, but it was not. It was the lawyers came up with as a legal definition that they could hang their hat on in their assassination plot, because you can kill a foreign agent that is hostile, right? That's what CIA does. It kills people, right? So, and of course, later that plot was realized and discussed in the highest chambers of power in the White House, and given a go. So that was a turning point, and I think that this is still the power that we are facing, more so than President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, or Attorney General Garland. It is that power. You know more about the details of how that works on the inside. I don't know fully the entrails of it, but we have past history to rely on to see what effect it can have. So that is, in my opinion, the dynamics and the politics that is pushing this case, and the reason why we have Julian Assange as a political prisoner.
Well, wouldn't it be lovely to see a bit more of Christian Hrafnsson all over the press here, because he seems to be, as he's now the editor of WikiLeaks, one of the people who's got his head most definitely around exactly what's going on, this whole concept, Martin, of the non-state hostile intelligence service, which I think we can proudly say we are one of those.
Well, also, of course, Pompeo is on the record as saying we should assassinate the Julian Assange, head of the CIA. Came straight out with it. No messing.
Yeah.
No kidding, eh? And that was under Trump.
So, just a couple more items to go. Both of them on the more spiritual side here. Finally, it's going to be David Livingston speaking a bit about Hamas. But before that, we're going to go to Nick Land. This is this old school friend of mine who's the father of accelerationism. David Livingston first pointed out to me. And here he talks, I mean, it'd be really interesting to get your take on this as well, Martin, because it's very much a philosophical thing about entropy. And entropy, for those that don't know, is this principle. I think it's Newton's first law of thermodynamics. Am I right? Where, which I seem to remember from my physics, is where things decay away, and there's energy in any system. That energy decays away, usually as heat or kinetic energy of some sort, and it ends up with less energy. So the idea is everything is slowly decaying. And the miracle, great miracle, of course, is that life is the opposite of that. It actually starts assembling things, and it's you know, builds buildings and things like that. The buildings don't fall apart, they get put together. Well, obviously they do in Gaza, but these are the sorts of forces of good and evil going on in the world, where entropy is trying to pull everything apart. So here is Nick Land talking a bit about that, and he's saying that it's almost like there's people from the future pulling our strings. So I'd be very interested to see what you make of his examination of accelerationism, as he talks about what he calls chaos entropy, that is to say things falling apart and actually making things fall apart more and more quickly until everything is chaos.
I think the first thing that's worth saying is about this complex that you touched on, to do with accelerationism and these thermodynamic notions about entropy. There's obviously one way of organizing one's thoughts about this, that sort of entropy is a bad thing. And what you're trying to do is escape entropy, move in the opposite direction of entropy to the degree that that's possible. Mm. I think ultimately that's not the best way to think about it. I think there's now this movement, which I'm sure you've kind of come across, but it's quite active on the internet, and then it calls itself EAPT.
Yeah. Yes, I've seen your comment on that.
Again, it's one of those things, it's unpronounceable, or something you can only write. I think it's a really interesting little name. I think it's like obviously that accelerationism, one of the things I really like about it is that it just is incredibly splitty. I mean, you know, and this little semiotic sort of slash ack, where people can stick something at the front to mark the fact that there's been another split or divergence or something has split off into another form of acceleration. I absolutely adore that. And yeah. EAC is the most recent one that I know about of any seriousness at least. And I think it's very solid on this question about entropy, which is that what one wants in a machine, or what is accelerating, is entropy production. Mm. That's to say, you know, the goal of this thing, the more powerful it is, the more productive it is the amount of entropy it's producing.
Yeah.
And everything, you know, life produces entropy more than the inorganic, and intelligence produces entropy faster than stuff that was not intelligent. And, you know, as we computerize and the socio-technical system becomes more and more elaborate, its ability to output entropy steadily increases. Mm. So it's basically, it's like, you know, it's the amount of chaos that you can absorb, or that you can manage or deal with, that really is the indicator of sort of health and advance and all of these things. It's not that you want order against chaos. You want to just basically have something that can tolerate the greatest, yes, amount of chaos.
Well, yeah, I was talking about it was between your faith in acceleration as compared to a decline with Spengler. Is that has the situation of this Lilith that's emerging, let's call it woke, whatever you want, has that this pulling back of acceleration changed your view about acceleration? And I mentioned also that Lilith seems like it does seem like it's not just time. It seems like it's almost a figure trying to pull back acceleration in a way. This equalizing force of wokeness and
I mean, I think this is extremely interesting, and it's right on the edge of where I see myself for sure. I mean, it's the zone full of questions. I know that the guideline, you know, if I'm trying to go a little bit woo and say, look, what do I feel I'm being told, or if I'm, you know, to the extent I'm being, you know, I'm sensitive to a certain kind of guidance, or, you know, something saying you're going off the track here, you're losing something, you're forgetting something. What is that something? That something is always to do with underestimating the importance of retrochronic effect. You know, if you're serious about the fact that the direction of the notion that there is a progressive and overwhelmingly dominant, exclusively dominant progressive direction to time, that is the great fabric of the illusion. You know, there's no more fundamental structure to illusion than that particular assumption about the working of time. It's very, very hard to let go of that at all. You know, I mean, it's again, it's like this thing. You can sort of see intellectually, perhaps sometimes, that it's not like that. But everything about your brain and everything about the culture, all the systems that you're embedded in, are trying to kind of push you back, pull you back into the progressive nature of time.
So there he is, Nick, talking about the progressive nature of time. He does go on, and it's he's expressing something that's actually fairly simple, fairly complicated manner. But there he is, Martin, saying these silly fools that think that time is moving forward are getting it all wrong, because actually time is the things are inevitable, and actually time is coming back to get us. And if you're trying to rail against it, then you're wasting your time. But I mean, what do you make of some of the ideas in there? For example, the idea that entropy can be produced, massive amounts of entropy can be produced. I mean, we're talking about, when I say the word entropy, I'm thinking Gaza, I'm thinking things being smashed to pieces by humanity. And he seems to think that this is a good thing, that the accelerationists are actually producing what he calls more output of entropy. Because surely that's the opposite of what we want.
Well, I've forgotten the name of the Spanish historian, Fernandez, I think it may be called, but he'd written a history of civilization, and he said, just for the sake of this book, we're going to think of civilization as being the more civilized societies are the ones that use more energy. Yeah. So, a hunter-gatherer lifestyle uses a very limited amount of energy. Our society uses loads of energy. And that's the definition of civilization I'm going to use for this book. And in a sense, that's right, because the more our civilization has become successful and progressed and developed new technology, the more destructive in many ways it becomes. Because all creatures have to destroy other creatures in order to exist themselves. So when he's saying about...
Well, I don't think that's true at all. Well, they can do.
They usually do.
Is a sort of choice, isn't there, as to whether you're working with nature or against it.
Yes, obviously, and if you overdo it, you can then your system crashes, and we've seen that happen in the Maya civilization, in all sorts of civilizations, because they don't understand that.
Well, it looks as if actually this accelerationism is all about crashing this civilization.
Exactly, that's the point I'm making, and of course. He's presuming, I mean, there is a question about whether there is a progress in history and we're all supposed to be going somewhere. And of course, modern biologists do not think of evolution as a progress anywhere. It's a random walk.
It could end up in anything. And there's no morality involved in things getting more complicated or less complicated. It's just stuff. And so this whole idea is a 19th century idea. You mentioned Spengler there. Spengler wrote the book The Decline of the West, which is very influential in the creation of fascism, because it broke, you know, it's the sort of thing that you get from Trump in a very watered down form, is that, you know, our civilization is being undermined by wokeness and all these so-called progressive values.
He sees societies as, Nick does anyway, sees societies as, he's valuing them, the better societies can absorb more and more chaos. Well, why should they have to absorb more and more chaos?
Well, it's deliberately provocative, yeah, isn't it? Because well, in actual fact, most like common him, people think what we really need is more order. You know, we don't want chaos in the world. In our personal lives, we try to avoid chaos, don't we? We don't jump out of a window to kill ourselves, because most of the time we actually want to go to bed tonight and have a nice dinner. So, you know, it's counterintuitive. And one of the problems you've got in the field of philosophy is that people who come out with provocative stuff are remembered.
You
because
might,
it's
you,
like, oh, yes, that's I that. Mean, you may thought say, of it like that. You, but, of course, it's in defiance of common sense.
You may well say, well, why is it worth listening to Nick Land about talking about all this? Well, the fact is that there is a whole movement of accelerationists, of which one of the most interesting is this guy Larry Fink. He's always using this term, accelerate this, accelerate that. And, of course, they are. He's the chairman of, or is it the CEO of BlackRock? They're one of the people that what they're seeing is effective. This is providing a kind of Ayn Rand style philosophical cover for a kind of fascist system. That's a corporate system where banks are just buying up everything.
Well, I mean, Ayn Rand was simply, you know, I mean, I find it extraordinary that all these people, like the head of the Greenspan.
But these greedy people always need someone like Nick or Ayn Rand to provide them with some sort of philosophical justification or cover.
That's right. And they used to have quite sophisticated philosophical cover. But Ayn Rand, as a philosopher, is farcical. She just said, everybody should just be selfish. And if everybody's as selfish as possible, then that will be good. Mm. And, of course, the weak will go to the wall and the strong will...
Yes, I think Nick is a bit more sophisticated than that.
Yes, but at the same time, it's still... I mean, from my philosophical training in the English philosophical tradition, if it sounds like nonsense, it is nonsense. If you can't explain it in simple words, then it's probably junk.
Okay, well, our final piece, and I'll put a link to the full interview Dave sent me about that with Nick Land there, if you can bear it. I mean, it's all sorts of bizarre stuff, and it's so bizarre hearing him. And, like I said, I did put out a request to interview Nick, and it'd be really interesting to try and do that at some point. If anyone has got any links, please do. I've already pinged him on Twitter and had someone send him an email. It'd be really interesting to try and pull him apart on some of these things. I don't know if he'd be really up for it, but anyway, it's certainly worth a shot.
He's in Shanghai, I understand.
In Shanghai, over in Shanghai, yes. God knows what he's up to over there, but anyway. So a final piece this week is with David Livingstone, who first introduced me to Nick in his new presence. And, you know, he's the sort of person that influences people. One of the key people is Peter Thiel. These people are all into this stuff, and some would even call it satanic. But David Livingstone tonight, he talks about, from his one of his most recent articles, and another longer interview up on our show page later tonight with David. We'll probably have some more from him next week. Talks about the origins here of Hamas.
You can trace it all back to the same source of Moses Mendelssohn, right? So you're looking at three traditions that came out of, let's say, the Asiatic Brethren, the Frankfurt Newton Lodge, and they are Theosophy, which evolved into Aristotelian Hitlerism, and Zionism, and Salafism, which is the affliction in the Islamic world. You have one person in particular, his name is Jamaluddin al-Afghani. And Blavatsky, she acquired her teachings from these disembodied spirits that went by various names, several ascended masters, she called them. And one of them was Jamal al-Afghani, who was supposedly one of the masters of the Brotherhood of Luxor. And so this is the same tradition that goes back to the Asiatic Brethren, and by another name, by another personality that he took on, going by the name of Haji Sharif, he introduced Saint-Yves d'Alved to the secret of Agartha, which gave birth to the Synarchist tradition. By yet another personality, by his name of the supposed Islamic reformer, also Grand Master of the Freemasons of Egypt, he founded what's called the Salafi Reform Movement of Islam. So what's important is that Islam had a unified legal tradition that was followed practically unanimously throughout the Sunni Muslim world for about 1,000 years. And so the purpose of his mission was to undermine it, because he was working in league with the British, particularly people like Lord Cromer in Egypt, other people like Scallon Blunt, who again was linked to this entire network, the Theosophical Network, and E.G. Brown. Anyway, so what they needed to do was to, he proposed that Islam was falling behind the West because it was holding on to a stagnant legal tradition. And the only way to revive Islam was to free it from the stranglehold that had been placed on it by this tradition and to reform it. So that's effectively the basis of this Salafi movement. Where they first achieved support was in Saudi Arabia. His student, his name was Rashid Rida, was the first one to create an alliance between the Wahhabi movement. Wahhabi movement was, again, there's an excellent article online, was originally written in Arabic, was translated. In fact, there was I posted it on my website back in 2004, I think, that the Americans had discovered a document produced by Iraqi intelligence that claimed that the Saudi royal family were descended from Donmay Sabakians, and that Abdul Wahhab, the founder of the Wahhabi movement, was again also a Donmay Sabakian, out effectively to undermine Islam. So the Wahhabis and the Salafis had pretty much the same mission, which was exactly that, which was to throw away centuries of Islamic legal tradition and to quote-unquote reform it and free it to sort of reinterpret Islam for modern times, which is effectively what they've done. So with Saudi funding, which came from the Rockefellers, because it's all through collaboration with SoCal Rockefeller Oil Company for the exploitation of oil in Saudi Arabia, which became the third largest source of petroleum worldwide, that they achieved enormous wealth. They carried out what is considered to be the largest propaganda campaign in history, which was for the spread of this philosophy, Salafi cult. They have effectively, the estimates claim that they control up to 80% of the mosques outside the Islamic world, so in the West, like places like Britain, United States, and Canada, where they've been managed to spread this Salafi message, which goes back to this Satanist Jamal al-Din Afghani. So out of the Salafi movement came established, I can't remember what year it was, I think it was 1928, with British support, was the foundation of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is effectively a crypto-Masonic organization. The founder was Hassan al-Banna, and he was recruited to put the Muslim Brotherhood at the service of Nazi intelligence. And this is why you find a very close relationship between the Nazi Brotherhood going on for many years, both before World War I, or leading to World War II, sorry, and after World War II, including with people like Skorzeny and Reinhard Gehlen and that network. They were discovered, and you know about Miles Copeland. Miles Copeland is the one who revealed that the Muslim Brotherhood was through and through at the disposal of pretty much any intelligence organization worldwide. And And especially after World War II and the fall of the Nazis, basically control of it was handed over to the CIA. And so from that time forward, the Muslim Brotherhood has been an essential tool of American colonialism in the Middle East. So, for example, when they wanted to invade Afghanistan, they did so. This was admitted by Brzezinski, that they did so by funding the Muslim Brotherhood, which gave the knowing that it would give the Russians no choice but to invade. And then they continued to do so using bin Laden as a bagman to deliver the funds that were collected through the Iran-Contra operation through the sale of cocaine through Nicaragua and their networks with the Mossad. This is an operation, of course, that was incepted by Michael Dean, who was the leader, Zionist leader of the neoconservatives, and in close collaboration with the Saudi royal family, particularly two characters, which was Khalid bin Mahfouz, who was the leader of the Saudi Commercial Bank, I think is what the name is, and Salim bin Laden, who was bin Laden's older brother, working closely with George W. Bush in Texas at the time. And, of course, all those funds were being funneled through MENA, Arkansas, under Bill Clinton's supervision. So that basically just to give you a very basic idea of, in fact, there's a whole strategy that was developed during the 50s by the CIA, American government, called the religious factor, where they identified the Muslim Brotherhood as the necessary tool for effectively the fight against communism, as they called it in the Middle East. So when the Israel needed a boogeyman that they could use as a cover for their colonial actions, they created Hamas, founded by a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
So there you go. The track of Hamas, where they came from. I don't think anyone's saying that there is not legitimate grievances, but of course the idea is that the evil empire, what they do is they control both sides of the chessboard by controlling both sides of the chessboard. And you can see that, if you want, as a Masonic carpet, the way they have all their little squares, the white and the black squares right across the Freemason hall. In at least in the lower degrees, in the higher degrees, like the Royal Arch, what you'll find is a nice red carpet with these little bits of golden threads drawn through. And guess what? Well, how about that gigantic Star of David in a circle, and then another little line to another. And this is, I mean, this is the Royal Arch Lodge here in Bristol. That's what they've got. And many of these old Templar ports. So it does seem pretty obvious that these Masonic secret societies, as well as the Orders of Knighthood, like the Teutonic Knights, the Knights of Malta, the Order of the Garter, particularly here in Britain, are all the places where these people hide. At least they think they can hide there. And you know what? They all work on narcissism, don't they? Oh, we think you're going to be a great knight. We're going to make you a great knight. And it's all about pride, and it's all about ego. Anyway, thanks very much to David Livingstone. I'll put the full version of that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Gave us a very interesting, I think, look at Eastern religions and the differences between them, and the way that the West has procured certain types of Eastern religion as the big Eastern religions. So that will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Thank you very much again to David, as well as we've got quite a few other interviews this evening. We've got also the one with Vanessa Bealey, as well as Farouk Sadiq too. And we'll have John Gideon Hartnett next week talking about the best way to avoid getting cancer and what he thinks, how it all works. So time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, now strolling off home. And also our guests on from the Bristol Tree Forum, that is to say John Tarleton and Vasily Papastravron. Also, so thanks very much to them, and also of course to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly newsletter and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. My paperbacks, there's The Traitors of Arnhem, and also another one called The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're available. The show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week. Dave, can you just tell me whether the Sputnik stream is still going out? Yep, so we've got Sputnik quite a lot of the time. That is the Russian English language show on this stream. This show, as I say, is on 11 Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. all week. If you missed it and you want to come back, they will be here on this stream at talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday here. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. As I said at the beginning, please do just uninstall it and reinstall it. It takes up much less space and seems to work loads better. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
My sweet Lord, hallelujah. to do, I'm going to send you some backup. Dozen agents headed your way.